In the meanwhile, we have Obama talking about entitlements, and you and I are like...
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, fellow clock punchers, wage slaves, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Patricia Hine about her series over at truthout.org, War and the Tragedy of the Commons. A seven-part series, which I think is fantastic. But you're taking a look at what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and all of the wasted opportunities, the lives, the treasure, and our future. It'll be interesting to talk to her about that. Also in the first hour, John Byland. He's one of the students at the Hershey Sweatshop, if you will, here from Romania under the J-1 visa program. We're going to hear his story and about what happened today. The kids went out and another protest at the Hershey Story Museum wanting to deliver their petition of 67,000 signatures. They eventually went over to the Hershey Trust Mansion, where one of the secretaries took it. But here again, Hershey doing everything they can possibly do to inflame, incite, and make this thing that much worse. Going to talk about that. In the second hour, Mark Anderson from Labor.DailyCo is going to be here talking about teacher pay, what's going on in Wisconsin. And look, I could balance budgets better than anyone. I could do better than Kasich. I could do better than Walker. I could do better than Corbett. If only I could steal, which is basically what they're saying Walker is can get away with there. By stealing wages away from teachers, stealing benefits back, doing what corporate America has been doing to average, everyday working people in this country. And you know what's weird? We, the working people, have kind of turned and said, yes, steal those wages. Steal those benefits back, yes, because it's what's been happening to us. Instead of saying, hey, how about stopping our wage theft? How about looking at how we've been abused? How about a little group therapy for us? Something. But not going there. Also in the second hour, Jimmy Hoffa, general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, going to be here talking about the comments over the weekend. The right, just masterful in their manipulation, in their misrepresentation, and in the just flat out false nature of their reporting. We're going to talk about that in the third hour. Alex Han, deputy director of Stand Up Chicago, he's going to be here calling for a fair deal on the Trans-Pacific trade policy that, again, more of these trade deals coming up. It's just one of those things. And we will get to that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. How was your Labor Day? I had a very, very good Labor Day weekend. Spent a lot of time at home with the family, doing the family thing, but also doing a little bit of thinking about the past, talking with friends and family about, the things that I've been talking about for the longest time. How did we get here? How did we get into this situation? How is it that workers now have virtually no power on the job? They have virtually no say. And when you tell people that, like Pennsylvania being an at-will state, that you can be fired for any reason and really no reason as long as it doesn't violate one of the federal mandates, age, sex, race, one of those things. But if it's, you know, hey, I don't want you around. There's the door. There's nothing illegal against that. Your only recourse, collect unemployment benefits. And in this day and age, you know, that kind of thing could be, well, almost a death sentence for families. And I think back, and I was fortunate enough to have an op-ed published in a couple local newspapers. And, you know, I got some very positive responses out of it. And you can read it over at our Facebook page, Rick Smith or TheRickSmithShow.com, or the Rick Smith Show there. Again, looking back at how we got where we are today. And, you know, as I said on Friday, you know, my grandfather's generation, though, the one they call the greatest generation, when they came back from World War II, they had fought the battles. They had fought the war. They had fought, and that, to be honest, drew them together. So they were really a very close-knit generation. So when they came back into the workforce, they said, we didn't fight and nearly die for this. We didn't lose tens of thousands of our brothers and sisters. And we didn't go through all this to come back here and to starve. We didn't come back to from the war to not be able to have a decent life. And what they did is they built the largest middle class in the history of civilization. And they did that by coming together. And what's going on over the last 30, 40 years in this country is this all-out frontal assault by business interests at organized labor. And they've almost made it, you know, the beatable stepchild, if you will. And now everybody, you know, it's almost chic to beat up on unions. It's almost in vogue to go after organized labor and say, well, you know, they're overpaid. When the reality is the rest of the country, if you look around, is sorely underpaid. But here again, you know, it's all in the messaging and it's all in who controls the message. And I look this weekend in particular. Now, you know, most people, I don't care what your thoughts of Jimmy Hoffa are. When I heard what Fox News said he said, my first reaction was, well, good, it's about time. And here's what fake news over at Fox put out as Jimmy Hoffa's piece.
President Obama, this is your army. We are ready to march. Let's take these son of a out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
Now, that sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like it was... I mean, I was like, yeah, great. This is what I've been talking about for some time. And I'll stand by that. But here's what he actually said until the scissor masters over at fake news at Fox get a hold. This is what was really said.
Everybody here has got a vote. If we go back and we keep the eye on the prize, let's take these son of a bitches out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
See, they went in and they scissored out the part about everyone having a vote and everybody having the ability to boot them out. Now, you listen to the actual version, and that's pretty tame compared to what you hear the Tea Twizzlers talk about. That's fairly tame to what I've heard at Tea Party rallies and the emails that I get and the communications that I see. Fairly tame. I mean, if I were Hoffa, I would be much more upset. When you look at the reality that the working class of this country have been so badly decimated, and the wealth that they create rising straight up to the top, and the presidential candidates on the Republican side of the aisle, they want to continue that. They want to make it that much worse. They want this to be a right-to-work nation. And what that means is that you don't have the ability to do what my grandfather's generation did, which is to come together collectively and say, you know what? We want a fair shake. We want a fair slice of the wealth that we create through our labor. It will be illegal. That's what the business community wants. They want to make it so difficult to replicate what my grandfather's generation did, what that greatest generation did, which was to say, you know what? We're not putting up with this. We're not going to work for bread. We're not going to work for poverty wages. We're not going to work without some type of health security, without some type of retirement security. Not going to happen. We're going to make sure that our children have a better opportunity than we've got, and we're going to make sure that we build a nation of, for, and by we the people, not we the corporations. And you look at the corporate trolls who the billionaire class controls in this country, and immediately they seized on Hoffa's piece. And just on that one little clip, we're gonna get him out. We're gonna take him out. So all the T-twits, they got all in rage, got their panties all up in a twist. Well, Obama should apologize. Obama shouldn't apologize. Not for that. Especially when there was nothing wrong. I mean, the people who should apologize, fake news on Fox. Because after all, they're the ones who did the creative editing. But that's nothing new for them. We have seen so much creative editing out of them over the years. You remember the Glenn Beck rally that had 1,400 million people? Remember that? Where you had people in bikinis and parkas on a sunny day and on a cloudy day at the same time? Remember that? Where they kept showing pictures of crowds from whatever. No one knows what the crowds were, but they know that there were people walking around, and that must have been Glenn Beck people, because fake news said it was. And remember where they had palm trees in one scene where they're saying Wisconsin's beating people up with palm trees in the background in the middle of February. But that's good reporting. And I look at this report that just came out. A professor over at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, a guy named Kenneth Thomas. He went through and he did a little bit of number crunching from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. And what he found was that workers in this country were much more vulnerable than workers in any of the other OECD countries. That's the rich democracies. Those are the wealthy countries. And he even went to the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, went with them, a number of other ones as well, to look at how people being fired unfairly and not getting back pay or not getting severance, not getting any notice for mass layoffs or being fired at all. He kind of said, not only is the United States in last place, not only is this the worst country for workers, it isn't even close. We're not even in the ballpark, especially when he talks about being, a mouse stuck on a wheel of temporary positions. And I look at these kids over at the Hershey factory, these J-1 students who came over here for some cultural exchange program, end up working in a factory. They've seen what this temporary, part-time, non-permanent employment has gotten them. And it's not. It's not even close when you look at regulations on temporary employment. We're not even close to any other country in the world of the OECD countries. And I got to tell you, that's scary, scary stuff. So I hope that this Labor Day, we stopped, we enjoyed time with our families, but we also started to think about what labor is in this country, and what do we want to work for? Where do we go from here? Hope to hear your ideas. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with Patricia Hines.
Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Secretary Treasurer Dennis Williams says the Auto Workers Union is vigorously working to organize foreign automaker factories in the U.S. And he says, despite concessions the UAW has given up recently, American workers at those foreign automaker plants have strong reasons to join the United Auto Workers.
By joining it together and having the union like the UAW, they can have a voice, a true voice in the workplace. When they have concerns, whether it be quality, whether it be health and safety, they have a true voice. We have voted as an entire executive board to go after the transnational plants in the United States and to use all the resources necessary to achieve this.
The UAW is trying to convince foreign automakers to stay neutral in union organizing drives. Williams says current UAW leadership believes that a non-adversarial relationship best serves both workers and unions in auto factories.
We want companies to be very profitable. If they're profitable, our members are profitable, and the standard of living raises, and the communities have more of a tax base. So to have an adversarial relationship just don't make sense. We are prepared to spend millions of dollars on organizing their facilities. It doesn't make good business sense for them to fight a worker's right to have a fair democratic election.
As people in Ohio battle to repeal an attack on collective bargaining rights, there's new data showing worker wages there have fallen since 2000. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohioans that are lucky enough to be employed are on average earning less. A study recently released by Policy Matters Ohio discovered that the median hourly wage in Ohio has fallen by 86 cents since the year 2000. The median wage is now $15.16 per hour, down from $16.02 per hour, a pay cut of nearly $2,000 for full-time hourly workers. That wage drop isn't completely universal in the state. The top 10% actually saw their median wages increase by 2.4%. The median wage loss for the bottom 50% of wage earners was 5.4%. The drop in wages in the state likely isn't a surprise to economists. According to the study, Ohio was responsible for a quarter of the job losses in the United States during the last decade, and when the unemployed do find new work, it tends to be at a lower wage. Ohio wasn't alone when it comes to states seeing a wage cut. The Buckeye State leads a pack of 10 states where wages went in the opposite direction of the national average. Nationally, the median wage has increased over the last decade by 51 cents per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as we follow, let's save some for tomorrow.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Remember last week we talked about the Wartime Contracting Commission's report on how the Bush wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course Obama's war in Afghanistan, has reaped some $60 billion in waste and fraud with our privatized war supply chain. And the money, while enormous, I think pales in comparison when you look at the lives lost, the lives ruined, and the lives in the future who will be broken. And you have to ask, was it really all worth it? And I've always said right from the start, absolutely not. But here to talk about her seven-part series, Patricia Hines, she's written this over at truthout.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Patricia Hines' name. It'll take you right there. Patricia, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, glad to be here.
You know, I look at this whole misadventure in the Middle East brought to us by the Bush administration, and I say, you know, there's so much we've lost, the lives, the treasury, the opportunity, never to come back, and what lessons have we learned from it?
Well, why don't I walk through what I think would be most interesting for you and for the show. It's the cost of life, treasury, and lost opportunities of U.S. militarism. And with a focus on the Middle East, and I think that'll answer your question.
Okay.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to say that per capita, the military, with their national security and intelligence advisors, civilian defense contractors. They're the ones that your show just said, you know, squeeze the government for $60 billion above the cost.
Above and beyond, right.
Yeah, and elites of government, that they're the most polluting of the human population. And let me put numbers on that. There are about 1.4 active military now. A lot of them are involved in fighting the war in Afghanistan. They were in Iraq, and a lot of them are still there. Some in the war in Libya, you know, others operating drones, et cetera. They are 0.0002% of our population, and yet they contribute 5% to current global emissions, you know, that are fueling global warming.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to expend an awful lot of energy to make big rocks smaller.
It's tremendous, and actually there's a parallel across the 20th century. The parallel is, first of all, in who's killed in war. Secondly, where wars are waged. Thirdly, types of wars waged and the type of equipment, which is like so gas guzzling. And fourth, the impact on the environment and environmental health. So let me, and this is the cost of war to life. The trend across the 20th century, who was killed in war, has shifted since World War I, when it was mainly soldiers, you know, in battlefield warfare that were killed, and fewer civilians. Maybe 17% of who were killed were civilians.
Right.
The end of the century, there were 9 civilians killed for every soldier. Now, in the Iraq War, it's even more civilians to soldier. The best figures on the Iraq War that I've seen are somewhere between 200,000 and 1 million Iraqis were killed in that war.
Yeah, and we wonder why they don't like us.
Exactly, yeah. And also why the country's in shambles. If you have a war that decimates, I mean, that kills 5% of their population, I'm saying 1 million because that's the best study I've seen, but that also has had another quarter of their population leave the country because of the war and the shambles that it put the country in.
Yeah, we've caused a massive refugee problem there.
Extraordinary. In fact, the biggest in the world. Between Iraqis and Afghanis, that is the largest. There are 50% of people fleeing war in the world, and that's due to simply two wars that we're engaged in. So compare the 1 million, which I think from studies is the better number killed, to our soldiers killed, which was 4,200, roughly, plus a few hundred private military contractors. At the same time, we had about 32,000 wounded. And I would say for any war we wage currently, Afghanistan, I mean, where we're on the ground, not like Libya where we both, there was no boot on the ground, but that you have an 8-to-1 wounded to killed, that is, of our soldiers. But the fact is, when they come home wounded, what do they have? Brain injuries, loss of limbs, mysterious diseases. They are much more severely injured.
Yeah, and those are just the things that we can see. That's not even talking about PTSD.
Exactly. And that apparently is like 20 to 25% of people coming home from Iraq and most likely Afghanistan.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, when I was a kid, and this is, you know, I'm an anti-war guy from the beginning. I'm not a pacifist, as some people may think, but I remember growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland.
Oh, yeah.
And those guys coming back from Vietnam when I was a small kid, I remember them being dumped, literally dumped back into society with no help. They were missing limbs. They were missing parts of their mind, horrible drug and alcohol problems, and they just dump those men back into our community, and I fear the same thing happening now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people, and I grew up in the same generation as you, and a lot of people say that, you know, the problem with the returning Vietnam vets was the way the country received them.
Right.
And it's blaming it on their reception, and I would say that, yeah, it was a very harsh reception on the part of those of us who are anti-war. But at the same time, those soldiers were exposed to Agent Orange. It was never acknowledged by the VA. And so subsequently, you know, years later, they've had severe health problems. And so it wasn't just the anti-war U.S. public. It was their own VA who to my mind, dumped them. Now, the fact is that today, in quotes, soldiers are not dumped. They're greeted back. It's supposed to be a patriotic response to them. There are warriors. You know, they are fighting for democracy and liberty. But
sure.
The fact is,
there are heroes.
There are heroes. The fact is that the people coming back, men and women from the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, are ending up with the same statistics as the Vietnam vets.
Absolutely. And
similar,
my question.
Yeah, similar rates of PTSD, similar rates of homelessness, similar rates of unemployment,
yep.
Similar rates. In fact, suicide, you know, you probably read this as I did or heard this, that there are as many suicides of soldiers in Afghanistan as there are deaths.
Yeah, it's just outrageous. And you know, the thing I've been saying for the longest time is, if this is how we're going to treat the people that we call heroes, I don't know where we're going to get the next generation of heroes. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Patricia Hines. She's written a great series, War and the Tragedy of the Commons, over at truthout.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. I'll take you right to this series. You know, I look at this, and one of the things that you brought up in your series was talking about depleted uranium weapons. And, you know, you look at what we've done to Iraq, and I mean, just shelling them and leaving these behind, causing birth defects and who knows what from now to 1,000 years from now. And there's almost no talk whatsoever about not only the Iraqis, but also the guys coming back who have high levels of uranium in their systems. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. And I'm going to compare it also to Agent Orange. And I'll start with Agent Orange and come up to depleted uranium. Agent Orange, which you know, everyone knows, was heavily used in Vietnam. It was actually developed during the Second World War, but it was first used as genuine chemical warfare in Vietnam. And there are millions, you know, 3 to 5 million Vietnamese who were sprayed with it. Half a million have died. Many, three generations later, carry genetic defects from it. Well, the U.S. was so slow in acknowledging, even though documents show they knew it before they used it in the war, but decades later, veterans from that war, U.S. veterans, had to fight with progressive science researchers, some of whom I worked with at BU School of Public Health. They had to fight to get recognition of and then payment, minimal payment for exposure to Agent Orange. And today, I mean, this is decades later, everybody who served in Vietnam is presumed exposed to Agent Orange, and they, if they have symptoms, which would be, I mean, a number of cancers as well as reproductive disorders, as well as disorders in children, their children, like spina bifida, et cetera, they can apply for benefits to VA. It doesn't mean they'll get them, but at least they're presumed exposed.
Right.
Okay, so what I want to do is contrast that with depleted uranium, which the U.S. is using, I'm sure, in Libya, and the missiles that have been used there, but has been using since the Balkans. Then in the Gulf War I, Gulf War II, so Iraq is thoroughly contaminated with it. And cities, Basra and Fallujah, I wrote about in my piece, are seeing excessive disorders that remind me of what Vietnam was seeing with Agent Orange, but deformed children, extraordinarily deformed, frighteningly deformed. Many cancers, especially childhood cancers, leukemia, etc. And so depleted uranium was sort of passed off, as was Agent Orange. Agent Orange, an herbicide to protect our troops. DU has been, it's called DU, has been talked about the same way. It gives us better fighting ability. It gives us better likelihood of a kind of winning in the battlefield, so to speak, the air battlefield. And at the same time, what it is doing is, once DU-contaminated weapons hit their target, like tanks, for example, on the ground, what happens is that there is a whole burst of uranium-contaminated dust that anyone nearby will breathe, or later it gets into the environment and it could get into the drinking water, but also just onto fruit, vegetables being sold by local vendors, etc. But just high exposure to it. So that's both soldiers as well as civilians.
And the entire environment of where it's gone off. And the reason they use it is obvious. It's an effective killing tool.
Exactly.
And is it any surprise that we're going to deny those people, those soldiers, any access? I mean, you go back to the, you know, after World War One, when we sent the military in to crush the Bonus Army in D.C., and we've been doing that ever since, denying the promises that we've made. You know, I've heard so many people who've been in the military say, you know, they told me they'd take care of me.
Right.
If I served this long, if I served in combat, and it hasn't happened. This is where everyday Americans need to step forward and say, you need to uphold your obligations, because I ask that question again, who will then be the next generation of heroes in our time of need? Look what we've done to these folks to clean up 9/11 and how
exactly
long it took to get them benefits.
And also, I mean, what happens is there is government denial of their exposure when they put their lives at risk. That's what happened with 9/11 workers. I mean, even EPA, and I have to say that earlier in my life, after I graduated from graduate school in environmental engineering, I worked in the hazardous waste program of EPA in the early 5 years in the 1980s, 6 years. And actually, I think it's one of the finer of the federal governments, I'll just say that, which has still most people working for it still have a sense of the mission.
Yeah, so it isn't a job killing. It isn't the job killing organization of America.
No, it's not. No, and so I think it still attracts idealistic, you know, people, environmental engineers, et cetera, a few lawyers, but the fact is that federal government studies. I mean, this has been a pattern over and over with asbestos, Agent Orange, DU, the workers at Ground Zero. That government studies typically, the same with Vieques. I wrote about that in my series, Puerto Rico, where the Navy used it as a bombing range.
Right.
And federal government studies there afterwards. I mean, all of these studies, typically, you could predict it, will not find undue harm to humans or the environment.
Well, no, I remember my grandfather telling me about, you know, when the Marine recruiter came to the house when I was in high school. He told me, he said, you know, what does GI stand for? It was government issue, was his take. And I think that is what it actually stands for. He said, you know, if it's between you and a tank, kiss yourself goodbye. They can replace you, not the tank. But he told me the story of friends of his that he went to boot camp with, who we actually dropped the bomb on here in this country doing the experiments.
Mm-hmm. And it's in Los Alamos,
yep.
Southwest.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, it comes back down to, you know, you know, like you said, these reports, they always come out with, it doesn't cause any harm. No, just a little, they had a little sunburn. That was all.
And the other thing is they put, like, 100% proof of harm. The evidence of that before they will either provide compensation, provide health benefits, or refuse to use. In the case of DU, for example, until the government has unassailable proof that it is killing people, it will use it.
Yeah.
But, in fact, there are plenty of studies which are very suggestive of the harm of DU, as there were with Agent Orange prior to its use in Vietnam. But in that case, the government was deceptive. In the case of DU, my sense is that they didn't study it before they used it. And then they say, we're going to use it because it's effective in the battlefield, but until you can prove its harm. So this is not a precautionary approach, which is the arch principle, the golden rule principle of environmentalism, which is that you should be able to, you should prove that something is safe before you use it, not wait for proof that the proof of its harm.
No, but, I don't think, you know, nothing against what you said, but their thought is not about, you know, making things safe. Their thought is about killing people.
Their thought is killing people, and it's winning.
That's it. That's the bottom line. So yeah. Last question I've got for you.
Sure.
Other than reading the series, and it is a great series, War and the Tragedy of the Commons, written by Patricia Hines over at truthout.org. Of course, we've got a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. I think you write the truth out. What should we be doing to turn this tide? What do I do? What do our listeners do to turn this around?
Do you mean militarism around?
Well, I mean, the whole thing with DU and, well, militarism as a whole, I say you got to be active, engaged, and you've got to push
these
politicians in a direction where maybe they'll think before they get us involved in this stuff.
Well, I think, first of all, as citizens, I think there are international campaigns, for example, and I do list a number of those with the series that I wrote. There are campaigns to ban DU, which are based on the campaign to ban landmines and cluster bombs, which is one of the unusual and rare successes on the part of, it was actually civil society rather than governments, the campaign to ban landmines.
Yeah, because we don't want our kids walking through the field coming home with no feet.
And that won't happen here because we always wage war elsewhere.
Right.
So our landmines are in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, and our cluster bombs are in Iraq, and who knows what is in Afghanistan. Yeah, no, it's not going to happen here, but the fact is that there is a worldwide and successful campaign now against landmines. Of course, the U.S. hasn't signed it, nor has China and Russia. But the fact is that
good company.
It is the most probably successful international organizing effort to curb the harm of war. Now, there is a similar effort with respect to depleted uranium. And I would say that for those for whom this is a passionate issue, search it on Google. Educate yourself as well as possible. Write op-eds and letters to the editor and begin to actually give profile to that issue. It has very little profile in this country. It has much more profile in Iraq, for example, where the Ministry of Health has written to the UN because of the epidemic in child leukemia and stillborns and children born with birth deformities, et cetera. Women counseled not to have children. And so there's a lot more awareness in the countries where we've used these weapons. I think the other not so much promising but important issue that I'm seeing is in this country, first of all, we have the project called the National Priorities Project. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's actually out of Northampton, Massachusetts, near where I live. But they, and it's meant for popular use. What they do is dissect the budget. They look at the percent going to the military, which is more than 50% of our discretionary budget. I mean, as most of us know, more is going to military spending than all of the other sort of good social, economic, health, education.
And then there is where there are an awful lot of lost opportunity in that military budget. I've got to take a break right here.
Sure.
Again, the piece War and the Tragedy of the Commons, written by Patricia Hines over at truthout.org. Again, we've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Patricia's name. Patricia, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, and great series.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Presidential wannabe Rick Perry is flitting hither, thither, and yon, spreading little Perry tales about the economic miracles he has produced in Texas. Fantasy number one is a creationist story about jobs. As he recently flitted across Iowa, he gushed that he has built, quote, a job-creating machine in the state of Texas. And a Perry aide flatly said, the governor's job creation record speaks for itself. Actually, it doesn't. Probe even an inch into the million job number that Perry tosses around like fairy dust, and you'll learn that these are mostly jobettes that can't sustain a family. Most come with very low pay and no health care or pension, and many are only part-time or temporary positions. Indeed, more than 500,000 Texans now work for minimum wage or less, a number that has doubled since 2008, leaving Texas tied with Mississippi for the nation's highest percentage of its workforce reduced to poverty pay. Spreading even more fairy dust, Perry claims that his Texas miracle is the result of him keeping the government out of the private sector's way. But peek behind that ideological curtain, and you will find this startling fact. During Perry's decade, the growth in private sector jobs has been a relatively paltry 9%, while the public sector has more than doubled that, increasing the number of local, state, and federal workers in Texas by 19%. One out of six employed Texans are now teachers, police officers, highway engineers, military personnel, and other government workers, and many of these jobs were created with federal money, including cash from Obama's stimulus program. There's his miracle. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, joblessness is on the rise in Texas, and the whole Perry tale is about to go poof, thanks to his recent multi-billion dollar budget cuts that will destroy more than 100,000 good jobs throughout the state of Texas.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, you can go to the website, get the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app and take your class war on the go. So business analyst Gary B. Smith was on Fake News' Bulls and Bears Saturday afternoon, where he pulled that no-punches approach for corporate America, claiming the only way to get this economy jump-started, to get the recovery moving, you guessed it, ditch the minimum wage. And that it is nothing more, he said, than a form of price controls, and we need to get rid of that minimum wage. Then again, I guess we could always bring back slavery, but then the corporate overlords would have to feed us and house us and care for us. You know, and there's so much better when we have to fend for ourselves and they can pay us a pittance. So anyway, we were at the Hershey Story Museum today and then ventured over to the mansion where the Hershey Trust holds their little meetings. The J-1 students went and took their petition signed by 67,000 people from across the nation. And here to talk to us a little bit about this is John Bilan. He's one of the workers from Romania, I believe. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
Fine. Yeah, I've been tired after all these days.
It's been a long day. Can you tell me what happened today?
Yeah, in the morning we had a press conference with President of FL-CIO Pennsylvania, Rick Blumendell, and Vice President of SEIU, students, other fellows from ANG, and we talk about our strategy, and we tell to Hershey Trust and tell to the people that we not give up, we to continue to this struggle. Even the students in these days, they are flying back home. This is not the fight only of G1 students. This is the fight of, I think, entire America, entire labor movement, because they lost jobs. These jobs should give back to local people. So after we end this press conference, we go to Hershey Trust. With all of these students and these union members, and we knock on the door of Hershey building, and we give up this petition signed online by all these Americans, and in the same time we give them a report from the for an investigation of the Human Rights.
Right, Human Rights Commission.
Yes, exactly.
So let me ask you this. You know, we've been following this since the day it happened, since everyone came out of the factory there. We've been following this very closely. And a lot of the stories that we've heard are people like you who have come here hoping for some cultural experience I think back, my wife went over to Germany and went to Spain to experience that environment, had nothing like this. She didn't have to work 40 hours in a factory. What were you expecting coming here to the U.S.? What kind of an experience were you hoping for?
Yeah, before I came here, when I signed up, I believe I will work, obviously, but in the same time, I will believe I will have free time to travel around America, to meet Americans, to speak with them, this way to improve my English, and, of course, to get my money back that I invest in this program and everything. But in the first part of my program, in the first 6 weeks, that before the strike, I didn't get any of this because I didn't meet any Americans. I don't get money. I was so tired that I couldn't travel. But this situation changed after the strike, because in the last 3 weeks I traveled in New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. I meet Americans. I take dinner in their homes. So my situation was changed after this.
So after standing up and fighting back, you're now getting that exchange that you were hoping for. But let me ask you this, because a lot of the people who are negative toward what you're doing, and there are many who have some twisted, bizarre views on this. They say that you knew what you got into when you came here. So let me ask you, when this program was presented to you, did they in any way say you'd be working in a factory, lifting heavy boxes and living in an apartment, you know, in the middle of almost nowhere with no transportation?
They give us some information, but they don't give us all the details. They don't say you live 1 hour away by bus and you will stay in these conditions and all these details. They give us some information, but not all the details. That practically is more than important.
Did you have any say in where you were going to go?
Yes, I know. I'll come here. But they don't say exactly where is this. They don't show us where is this factory. And I am from Europe, and there we don't know so much things about Hershey.
Correct.
Actually, when I saw the job offer, I was for the first time I heard about Hershey. And I searched on internet, and I found interesting things because it's a huge company, it's a corporation, and I think I will work in the real chocolate factory, but actually I work in a warehouse in a field far away from civilization.
Let's talk about the wages you earn. I mean, some people are saying, well, $8 an hour, that's pretty good, shows you how bad the job market is here. But what do they take away from you after the $8 an hour into your check? What comes out of that?
Yeah, we agreed to work on that wage, but after this, there comes a lot of deductions, like we pay you rent. I pay $500 rent per month. I pay for transportation bus pass, it's $50 per month. We pay for the badge, that is when you punch in and punch out from the work. Test the drug and other things.
You have to pay for your own drug test?
Yes, and after 1 month of work, I gain $430.
Wow. That's like 110, not even 110 bucks a week.
Yeah, that's why we are not happy with this wage. So the first wage is $8, but there's come all the deductions.
So let me ask you now that you're moving forward with these protests and there's this movement of folks who are supporting you, what's the ask here? What are you guys looking for? Where do you see this thing going moving forward?
Yeah, we already announced this morning in the press conference that in the 23 September we'll have a big day of action, and we will get support from unions, from community, and all the students who are still here. Even we'll do that. But if Hershey will decide to talk to us, will decide to negotiate with us and give us what we want, like our money back, because we pay between $3,000 to $6,000, and give these jobs to local people.
Yeah, that would be a good start. And I find it amazing, to be honest with you, I find it amazing that you guys, all of the students there, have the same view that these jobs should be done with a living wage by people here in the country. It shows, it speaks well of you.
Yeah, we want this because we don't want any J1 students to come to work in this factory. And, of course, this will become available jobs for local people. So why they don't get it?
To the people who oversee the J1 program, what advice would you give them in tailoring this program to meet the expectations that you had? Not the ones that, not what would end up being, but what expectations you had of the cultural exchange?
For the future students, yeah. I will advise them to not come in this situation, to choose very careful of job offer. And I think this J1 program should be improved, and some of the participants to get more information about this. When we try to organize, I see a lot of students, they are afraid to organize because they think they will not get any support from authorities in America.
That's how American workers feel too, John. They feel that there's no support as well. But the question I was asking for policymakers, for the people who make the law, what advice would you give to them to change this J-1 system to make it work the way you had hoped it would work? Because I think that being part of a cultural exchange is that you have the ability to actually experience the culture instead of working in a sweatshop.
I think the major thing they should change is, like, these factory jobs should not be available for G1 students. For example, I study economics, and I should work in a economic position, like to learn to develop my skills in economics field. So if we have students who study medicine, they should work in a hospital, they should work in a clinic or stuff like this. And this is the major thing. They should have a lot of improvements to this program. One of these crossing my mind is, like, they should create a way we all use internet now, should get contacted with Department of State because they run this program to get information, to get support if something is wrong with our program. And I think a lot of things should change.
Yeah, I agree with you. When you go home, and I guess you're going to be going home in a couple of months, what will you tell the folks back at home about your experience here?
I will tell them the wrong side of America that before my strike, and I will tell them the beautiful side of America. That means individual Americans, they are beautiful people, they are wonderful people who help me, who support me, not in this struggle, but in the real life, they help and support us a lot. So America have bad sides and good sides, and I will tell them all about it.
Well, John Beilein, I appreciate the time. I hope the best. We will be with you every step of the way throughout this whole process. I appreciate your time, and thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. When I look at this, and, you know, John tells the story that we've been talking about, came to this country to be to learn about the culture, came to this country to experience what it's like to be here, so that he has a broader world view. And I got to be honest, I've been reading a number of these responses from people to the letters to the editors and all of this insanity that's out there. Well, they knew what they were getting into, and hey, it's tough out there, and all this bizarre right-wing sputum that they decided to regurgitate out. And I listened to this kid telling his story. Look, I wanted to come here to experience the world. And I would bet every person that wrote one of those hate emails or one of those hate letters to the editor or spewed any of that stuff on any talk radio program, I'll bet every single one of them to a T has never left this country and has never experienced life across the pond, has never experienced what it's like to be anywhere else but in their little four blocks. Because unfortunately, we seem to be a very closed-minded culture when it comes to stuff like this. And these kids, you know, these are going to be the future leaders in their country. And I got to tell you, you know, when my kids get to be old enough, they're definitely going to go and experience life somewhere else so that they can either see and appreciate what they have, or they can go, hey, they do something a little better, a little different. Maybe we can try that, to have the experience that I think is necessary in reaching across borders and knowing actual people. And what John said, I really just struck right there for me. real-life Americans he's finally got to meet. Not slave drivers, not the corporate special interest, not the boss, but actual real people that he's able to connect with. And that's what that program should be. For me, when I look at this, the right thing for Hershey to do, right from the start, get rid of XL, get rid of SHS, get rid of the whatever that nitwit group is, get rid of all of those. Take that factory back, make those union employees that they put under contract and they pay a decent livable wage and say, we're done with this shenanigans. We're done with the exploitation. We're done with the abuse. We're done with all of that. We're going to take it in-house and we're going to do the right thing. We're going to be the corporate patriots that we like to say we are. We're going to actually wave the flag and mean it. And those people are going to put back into the community. We're not, because as I've talked about, you know, we've seen people tell us that, you know, back in the 90s, when they had welfare reform, they figured out how to exploit, the program there, and they brought in minimum wage workers who got subsidies. And when that program ended, boom, they were out the door. They brought in another class of exploitable workers. And then when that was done, they got rid of them. Now they brought in the J-1 workers. And this program, and John was right on. You know, the kids studying economics, he should come here and see how things are done here so that he has the experience not only of interacting with people, but also interacting what it is he wants to do so that we build those relationships across borders. And as I remember, this program was set up with the Soviet Union in mind so that we have that ability to know each other across the Iron Curtain. Back then, we had the ability, and it was those relationships that we built at higher levels that kind of staved off a lot of problems. And now it's just turned into a program that big corporations have figured out how to exploit and profit from. And I got to tell you, I think that's flat out wrong. So again, I guess it's September 23rd, if Hershey decides that they're not going to play ball, and look, they have done everything wrong. From a PR standpoint, everything you could possibly do wrong. If someone was to write a dummy's guide to doing everything wrong with a crisis, this would be the case. This would be the test case that they would use. By completely ignoring these kids and allowing them to keep gathering media attention only makes it a bigger and bigger story. And it's not just about our little corner of the world. This story is going out all over the place. But this is a perfect example of something I've talked about quite often. The ability to make our little corner, our little piece of the world, a little bit better. Or in Hershey's case, a little sweeter. Because if we do that here, if we make our little corner of the world a perfect place, other people will want to emulate that. And maybe these kids would have gone home and said, you know what, I want to be like Hershey. Maybe they still will and start sweatshops in their own countries. I hope not. I hope what they learn from this is how collective action and how we the people can stand together, much like my grandfather's generation did, much like the greatest generation did. And they built the largest, wealthiest, most prosperous middle class in the history of civilization. And what these kids are showing us, we can do it again. We can stand up, fight back, and we can do this again. But it's going to take effort, it's going to take hard work, and it's going to take you and me standing together. So good stuff from John. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mark Anderson from labor.dailycos.com is going to be here talking about his piece, $500 a month less, talking about the Wisconsin teachers. We're right back after this.
Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
UAW Secretary Treasurer Dennis Williams says the Auto Workers Union is vigorously working to organize foreign automaker factories in the U.S. And he says despite concessions the UAW has given up recently, American workers at those foreign automaker plants have strong reasons to join the United Auto Workers.
By joining it together and having the union like the UAW, they can have a voice, a true voice in the workplace. When they have concerns, whether it be quality, whether it be health and safety, they have a true voice. We have voted as an entire executive board to go after the transnational plants in the United States and to use all the resources necessary to achieve this.
The UAW is trying to convince foreign automakers to stay neutral in union organizing drives. Williams says current UAW leadership believes that a non-adversarial relationship best serves both workers and unions in auto factories.
We want companies to be very profitable. If they're profitable, our members are profitable, and the standard of living raises, and the communities have more of a tax base. So to have an adversarial relationship just don't make sense. We are prepared to spend millions of dollars on organizing their facilities. It doesn't make good business sense for them to fight a worker's right to have a fair democratic election.
As people in Ohio battle to repeal an attack on collective bargaining rights, there's new data showing worker wages there have fallen since 2000. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohioans that are lucky enough to be employed are on average earning less. A study recently released by Policy Matters Ohio discovered that the median hourly wage in Ohio has fallen by 86 cents since the year 2000. The median wage is now $15.16 per hour, down from $16.02 per hour, a pay cut of nearly $2,000 for full-time hourly workers. That wage drop isn't completely universal in the state. The top 10% actually saw their median wages increase by 2.4%. The median wage loss for the bottom 50% of wage earners was 5.4%. The drop in wages in the state likely isn't a surprise to economists. According to the study, Ohio was responsible for a quarter of the job losses in the United States during the last decade, and when the unemployed do find new work, it tends to be at a lower wage. Ohio wasn't alone when it comes to states seeing a wage cut. The Buckeye State leads a pack of 10 states, where wages went in the opposite direction of the national average. Nationally, the median wage has increased over the last decade by 51 cents per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The right to bargain is the right that's fundamentally about power to the people. That's where it should be. It's called justice. It's called democracy. So hear this, Scott Walker, because your time is limited. Let us tell you what your big problem really is. It ain't your nagging, finger wagging, budget deficit. The problem lies with your moral deficit.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So the AP is reporting that the new face of poverty in the nation, that's working age America. The adults 18 to 64 now represent nearly 3 out of 5 poor people. These folks who actually have jobs. This is a change, they say, from the 70s when it was mostly children who were in the impoverished group. But now you're seeing working age people living in poverty. And is that the direction we're going to be going? The poverty rate now stands at 14.3%, or somewhere around 44 million people. And there are politicians across the country. I look at Wisconsin, I look at Ohio, who are working diligently to make our teachers part of that poverty class. And I always remember my good friend who retired as a teacher said, you know, back before we had the ability to collectively bargain, back before we could negotiate for wages, hours, and conditions and all of that, we depended on little Susie or little Johnny to bring that apple every day so we could have lunch. And they loved us. But when we wanted to buy our own apple, or maybe even a pear, that's when it turned. And I look what's going on in Wisconsin and other states across the country, and they're trying to send them right back into the poverty era. That's why I've asked Mark Anderson, who's written a great piece, $500 a month less, over at labor.dailycos.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at this piece that you've written, and, you know, Scott Walker's, you know, the claim is he's balanced the budget and he's done all these wonderful things. And my first thought is if I could steal, I could balance anybody's budget.
Yeah, and that's really what he's done. I mean, I look at, you know, what happened, you know, using my friend as an example, you know, they, you know, he has taken out of her and his and her wife and her husband's salary $500 a month, just plucked it out of their pocket.
Yep.
And which really is, it's much bigger than just them. That takes about $20 million out of Wisconsin's economy.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me, and that's a huge number, and it's important to remember. Here at, where I live in Carlisle, there was a big factory that made carpeting for the automotive industry. And the company was saying, we're gonna take $8 an hour away from you in this contract negotiations. And the union said, no, you can't cut our wage in half. And I talked to small business owners in town who were all in favor of it. Yeah, they should cut their wages in half. And I said, you know where that money used to be? You know that $8 an hour that worker used to make? That was your money. Your money's gone. And they didn't get it. That disposable income is what kept them and the entire local economy going.
Right, and that's exactly what it does. I mean, I look at, like, here in Madison, we're a college town. A lot of governments are, you know, also as the capital city, a lot of government offices here. Madison businesses are going to take a huge hit. And the thing is, I think the Madison businesses know that because the majority of them have been supporting the workers that have been protesting on the square.
Yep.
But there are a few that don't, and they just don't seem to understand what this is actually going to do to them.
Yeah, I mean, that disposable income is going to be taken from some segment of the economy.
Right.
And while they may think, oh, I'm going to save tax dollars, if you can't stay in business, if your local economy collapses, it doesn't matter. You're in big trouble.
Exactly.
So what's going on right now? I know that this is pretty much a done deal. Walker's been able to steal this away without sitting down and negotiating. And my first thought is, was he that bad of a negotiator? It was just a great opportunity to begin the assault on working people there, and which has gone across the country. I got to be honest, I wish I could steal like this and fill my pockets.
Yeah, it would be nice, but you know, I think, you know, people like us are too honest to do this. You know, for one, but he's following the same game plan that he followed in Milwaukee County when he was the county executive there. I think that Milwaukee County was actually happy that he won the governorship so they could get rid of him. But he's following that same game plan. He's trying to privatize everything. He is taking money away from labor, and he's giving it away basically in tax cuts to the rich and businesses. You know, businesses that, you know, I don't really understand why they're getting a tax cut, because it's not helping them.
Yeah, I mean, where are the jobs? I mean, if all these tax cuts are, which is the Republican platform, more tax cuts for the wealthy and business, deregulation, and of course more free trade, those are all supposed to be the panacea of job creation.
Right, right. And you know, the thing is, if a product's not moving off the shelf, they're not going to hire anybody to sell that product. And that's what's happening, is there's nothing moving off the shelf. You can give them tax cut after tax cut. Not going to do anything.
So the question then becomes, you know, in talking about your friends, what happens to the profession of teaching? What happens to education?
Right. Well, she's not a teacher, but she does work for the university system. And she works in a fairly important part of the university. And it's a situation where they are going to lose somebody with really good experience. And she's looking in the private sector right now. I actually know that she's going in for, you know, some interviews in the private sector coming up fairly soon. It's also interesting that I find, because I have another friend who's just applied for one of the many vacant jobs that are opening up in the state, where he was flat out told by the hiring manager that this job that would normally in the private sector pay $110,000 a year, he was told by the hiring manager the pay is going to suck.
Wow, well, that's a great way to get the best and brightest people working for your state.
Yeah, and you could tell, you know, he said that he could tell that this person was very frustrated. You know, like this person was having a very difficult time trying to find anybody to fill this position, and it's a position, like I say, in the private sector would be six figures, and it's not anywhere close to that in the public or in the public sector.
Well, at the end of this, you and I know you know, but and I think most people know that the goal here is to completely cripple government, to completely destroy it, and starve it to where it no longer functions at all. Which then the next logical conclusion is all public function will be done by for-profit interests.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy of the right. Government doesn't work, so we don't give it any money, so then it really won't work.
And I keep asking the question, why do we vote for these people who tell you, and you got to give them credit, they're honest. They tell you, I hate government, it doesn't work, put me in charge of it, and I will make sure it never works.
Yeah, I don't understand that. And, you know, it's like, you know, today I was reading the newspaper today. One of the school districts up to the north of Madison is going to actually have to end the practice of giving milk out to elementary age students for their morning snack.
Jeez,
because the state subsidy of $10,000 is going away.
And you stop me to think about the milk program. And, you know,
and we're in the dairy state. How hard can it be to get milk to these school kids?
And there is another perfect question to ask, but you stop and think about if we're going to be a war nation, stop and think where the milk program came out of. It came out of the Department of Defense because they said kids back, you know, 100 years ago were too malnourished to be able to fight.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, like I say, I live in the dairy state, and we can't give kids milk for breakfast or for their morning snack. It just makes no sense.
What we do? We give them Gatorade, or we give them sugary sports drinks.
Actually, what the article says is they're referring that referring the kids to drink water.
Oh, okay. Well,
for their morning snack.
Well, that's okay. But I'm telling you right now, you're going to see some good corporate sponsor come in and fill that void with Gatorade or some, not Gatorade, but some kind of sugary sports drink,
so yeah,
they can get into
school.
You ever see that movie, I forget what it's called, the one where democracy is just completely broken down with David Arquette? Where people have like a two-second attention span and they're actually watering the crops with Gatorade and sports drink.
Doesn't ring a bell.
It's a crazy movie, but it's the direction that we're heading in.
It is.
It's just plain nuts. So the question then is what are you guys doing about this? What are you doing to fight back?
Well, I was at Labor Fest yesterday here in Madison. One of the things I noticed was that the sign that they had on the electric message board at the Labor Temple was solidarity means everyone. And basically what we need to do is we've got to stand together and we've got to recall Scott Walker. We've got to get him out of office and we've got to fix all the damage that he has done. We cannot allow him to continue on for another year, another 6 months. We can't afford it. His policies are horrible for this country, and Republican policies are horrible for this nation. I mean, they are destroying us.
Yep. And not just there. It's all across the country.
It is. It is. I mean, a Perry presidency terrifies me. You know, even a Romney presidency terrifies me because they are going for the lowest common denominator, and they just want to stay in power, and they're going to do whatever it takes to get it. And that's not what is good for the nation.
Well, if you look at what the Koch brothers said the other day, I guess, he's been quoted as saying is, you know, Obama's like Saddam Hussein, and we need to spend as much money as we can to get rid of him.
Which I don't understand. I mean, he Obama's pretty much given them everything they want at this point. You know, I mean, I think he's a decent president, but I think he's got to stop giving in. There's got to be some point where he says, you know what, enough. You guys have got to stop doing this. This is not good for the country. You've got to stop doing what's best for your party. But I don't know when he's going to get to that point.
Yeah, I'm hoping this whole thing with Hoffa is something that pushes him in the right direction, starts a little controversy, and a little later on the program, we're going to talk with General President Hoffa about the comments, and so stick around for that. But as we go down the road here, in talking about a recall potential, do you see that gaining steam here?
The latest poll I saw, he was about 45% approval rating, so it still could go either way. I think, a big thing is we have to make sure we get the message out. The other thing is if this recall does take place, because it can't start until a year after he's been in office.
Right.
So we can start collecting signatures in November, which puts us in January when we can recall him. Now, the weather here in Wisconsin in January isn't so nice.
Yeah, pretty brutal.
So it really, you know, I think it could come down to what the weather is the day of the election. I mean, it really could come down to that.
You know, there's something really wrong when weather decides the future of your country.
It is. Unfortunately, it's a fact of life we have to deal with here in Wisconsin. But it literally, especially up in the northern part of the state, you know, where you may have to drive 2-3 miles to get to your polling place. If we have heavy snow that day, some people may not be able to get out to vote.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm kind of wondering, is January the best time to do this? Should we wait a couple of months?
Well, I'm hoping, I got to tell you, I'm praying that they'll be able to deliver that blow early next year so that maybe we can turn the nation around. Because if you're able to do that at the beginning of next year, maybe there's a shot come November of taking back the national scene as well as a number of the gubernatorial races around the country. Because I'm afraid they're going to lose the Senate.
I mean, I'm afraid of that as well.
You look at the numbers, and it's just not on our side.
It isn't, unfortunately. But on the flip side of that, you know, from what I've seen, it's possible that people are ticked off enough at the Congress we could end up taking the House back. It just seems like it could go back and forth. It's hard to say at this point.
Yeah, the other part that scares me is this ping-pong democracy where we go from extremes and nothing ever gets accomplished.
Right.
That's what worries me.
Right.
Mark Anderson, I appreciate the time. Labor.dailycos.com is the website. Mark's one of the featured writers over there at labor.dailycos.com. I appreciate the time, Mark. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Presidential wannabe Rick Perry is flitting hither, thither, and yon, spreading little Perry tales about the economic miracles he has produced in Texas. Fantasy number one is a creationist story about jobs. As he recently flitted across Iowa, he gushed that he has built, quote, a job-creating machine in the state of Texas. And a Perry aide flatly said, the governor's job creation record speaks for itself. Actually, it doesn't. Probe even an inch into the million job number that Perry tosses around like fairy dust, and you'll learn that these are mostly jobettes that can't sustain a family. Most come with very low pay and no health care or pension, and many are only part-time or temporary positions. Indeed, more than 500,000 Texans now work for minimum wage or less, a number that has doubled since 2008, leaving Texas tied with Mississippi for the nation's highest percentage of its workforce reduced to poverty pay. Spreading even more fairy dust, Perry claims that his Texas miracle is the result of him keeping the government out of the private sector's way. But peek behind that ideological curtain, and you will find this startling fact. During Perry's decade, the growth in private sector jobs has been a relatively paltry 9%, while the public sector has more than doubled that, increasing the number of local, state, and federal workers in Texas by 19%. 1 out of 6 employed Texans are now teachers, police officers, highway engineers, military personnel, and other government workers. And many of these jobs were created with federal money, including cash from Obama's stimulus program. There's his miracle. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, joblessness is on the rise in Texas, and the whole Perry tale is about to go poof, thanks to his recent multi-billion dollar budget cuts that will destroy more than 100,000 good jobs throughout the state of Texas.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I give my head to the new constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Money free with the teams all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray.
Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can go to the website and download our podcast or watch the video there. Or you can, if you've got a smartphone, Stitcher, the Stitcher app, take your class war on the go. Our quote of the day comes from a number of Democratic politicians, Tom Harkin, Patty Murray, George Miller, Rob Andrews. They wrote a letter in support of the NLRB. They said, in today's workplace, one in five workers who exercise the right to organize is illegally fired. In that environment, workers stop trying to organize, leading to a country where tens of millions of Americans who want a union do not have one. And I look back to what I talked about earlier, just real briefly in the opening, about this professor over at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Kenneth Thomas, basically saying, look, American workers are more vulnerable than any workers in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Those are the rich democracies. And, you know, even the BRIC countries we don't compare well to. When you look at the fact that you can be fired for any reason, you don't get severance pay half the time. You can, when there's a mass layoff, you have almost no notice, you know. And this whole idea of being a temporary, at-will employee. You know, the professor says, look, not only is the United States last, not only are they the worst on the list, it ain't even close, folks. Not even in the same arena. So you're not surprised by the Gallup poll that comes out and says that people are dissatisfied with their health care benefits, they're dissatisfied with promotions, they're less optimistic about their job and the prospects and everything that go along with it. No surprise. No surprise that, you know, out of the 13 categories surveyed, you know, dissatisfaction with one's boss or employers featured a decrease. That's it. So, you know, I look at this and I say, you know, people not happy with the health care, people not happy with their retirement, people not happy. So what do? Well, you do what these kids have done at Hershey. You say, you know what? No more. We're not going to put up with it. We're going to stand up. We're going to fight back. We're not going to take it. And that's the message that I really wanted to send when I wrote the op-ed that was published over the weekend. That generation understood that. And I wish that they would, if there's still some of them alive today, would tell this generation, look, here's the blueprint. This is what we did. This is what we did to make your life tolerable today. And this is what you need to do to make your children and your grandchildren's lives better. Because we are heading in the wrong direction. This idea that we should privatize and we need to be more business friendly by doing away with environmental laws and labor laws, you know, basically let business do whatever business wants, is ludicrous. It's insane. But that's what you've got an entire Republican Party saying, and a number of Democrats. So this Thursday for me is a huge day in my opinion. The president's going to come out with his jobs speech. I've heard numbers. I've heard proposals. I've heard thoughts all over the map. I've heard them saying, you know what, we need to invest heavily in roads and bridges. We need to spend $4 trillion $2.2 trillion just to repair our aging infrastructure. We need another $2 trillion to bring us up to somewhere near the 21st century. That's according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. There's so much opportunity there. And you know what's scary to me? The radical right in this country is dancing in the streets, jumping for joy that those three solar companies went down. That's what they think of this country. That's their hopes. That's their dreams. It's wrong. We're going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, we're going to talk with General President Jimmy Hoffa, President of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, right back after this.
This is the You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So yesterday at a Labor Day parade in my old neck of the woods, Parma Heights, Ohio, Dennis Kucinich said that Senate Bill 5 needed to be defeated. Not just defeated, but crushed. And the fundamental rights of democracy need to be protected, like the right of organizing. And, of course, the folks over at Fake News on Fox reported that Dennis Kucinich hates puppies. Again, you know, not surprising. Not surprising at all, especially considering you look at what they did to this office speech. Again, total chop job. And I played the clips earlier. Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit about that is the man himself, General President Jimmy Hoffa of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. President Hoffa, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm good. Congratulations. You've enraged the T-Twits.
Well, you know, the phones have been ringing off the hook, and guess what? The people calling are our members saying, finally somebody's saying what has to be done. Let's fight back. And it's been a positive day for us. Our members are energized. I think all of, you know, more people, I've had more calls today from people in other unions and saying, you know, we got to start talking that way. We got to start basically speaking out yep. against the war against workers and what they're trying to do to us. And I think that's the message. So it's a beginning. Kucinich is doing it. I saw the vice president did it in Cincinnati. We've got to start talking about where they want to, what they want to do to this country. There is a war on workers. They're taking away collective bargaining for public employees in Wisconsin. They're doing it in Ohio. They're trying to do right to work in 14 states, which we've defeated. And they're just getting warmed up.
Yep.
This is just the first round for them. And when they came back, they're going to come back with this and start all over again this September. So this war is not over. It's starting. But what I said in Detroit with the president was that we have the votes. You know, I always say the Republicans and the right wing has the money. We have the votes, and we've got to energize ourselves to be a mighty army to march to those polls and take back America for the Americans, which are working Americans. And that's my message. And that how they could misconstrue that into violence is ridiculous. I believe in voting. And you know what? We've got the votes to do that. And if I have anything to do with it, I will do everything I can to energize everybody in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, the whole country to get this job done.
Anyway, well, here's what you actually said.
Everybody here has got a vote. If we go back and we keep the eye on the prize, Let's take these son of a bitches out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
And, you know, I heard that after I heard this. And I got to be honest, I like the Fox News version. I got to be honest. This is the fake news at Fox version.
President Obama, this is your army. We are ready to march. Let's take these son of a bitches out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
See, I like that version. I mean, you know, the voting thing I get, okay, but I like the militancy. I like the fact that, just to be honest, I've been to Tea Party rallies. I've been to this stuff. Their verbiage, their language, their rhetoric, much, much more vile, much more angry, much more violent than anything you said.
Well, remember Sarah Palin with the scope sights, the rifle scope sights,
yep,
in Arizona. And remember Mitch McConnell saying that we're going to take out Obama. His job is to make sure Obama only has one term. What's that about?
Absolutely. So here's the
clear
question.
That, you know, they use that rhetoric all the time. They talk about wars, and there is a war on the workers, and that's what our signs say. We've got our signs everywhere, and people know what's going on, and we see it. But I think we're tapping into some real energy here, because what we see going on, the people are finally waking up. I always tell them, shut off Fox News.
Absolutely.
And listen to your union. We are fired up. We've got to get our members to the polls like never before. And they can't be, you know, listen to this talk about, oh, those deficits. Because when they start talking about getting rid of the deficits, they're talking about getting rid of people's Social Security, getting rid of their pensions, getting rid of health care, Medicare, Medicaid, that's what they're talking about. But when you talk about, well, why don't the rich pay a little bit more to help out? Let's all make a contribution. Oh, we can't do that. Those are the job makers, they say. So we know it's a one-sided rhetoric, and what we do, we know our reality. And our reality is to vote, 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 and take America back.
Absolutely. You know, you brought up the deficit, the dog and pony show there. The reality is I didn't hear what I think is the most important issue. And the most important issue to me is our massive and ever-growing trade deficit. If we had balanced fair trade instead of this bizarre model that benefits the wealthy over the working people, I don't think we'd be talking about our budget deficits. I don't think we'd even be talking about immigration. I think we'd be begging people to come here if we had balanced trade.
Well, we don't have balanced trade. And unfortunately, you know, you go back to NAFTA, CAFTA, and you go back to China trade agreement. Those were things that happened in the late 90s, and they're part of the problem we have. I only have to think about Hershey chocolate. You know, in Reading, Pennsylvania, they closed the plant down. I was there the day they closed it down.
I remember.
There were people there with 35 years of seniority,
yep,
and they closed the plant down and moved it to Mexico. They had 600 people out in California. They closed down a major part of what they did in Canada, all to get away from paying legitimate living wages. Now, what kind of a company does that? The other thing I talked about on a show over the weekend was Apple Computer. They have $76 billion in the bank, and yet they do not make their computers here. They make them in China through a front company. They employ 300,000 or 400,000 people. Are you trying to tell me with $76 million that they couldn't build a plant here and start putting Americans to work? You know, the amazing thing is in these companies, they make their money here. They line their pockets. They pay their CEOs, you know, $16-20 million. But they don't feel any obligation to take care of this country, to put people to work. So they'll take the money. This is the richest consumer economy in the world. But they take the money from here, put it in their pocket, and then they make the computers over there. Another thing is Honda's going to build a $1 billion plant. Guess where they're going to build it?
China.
Mexico.
Oh, Mexico.
Mexico, and they're going to make a car that they're going to sell here. Now, why don't somebody call up? Why doesn't the president call up Honda and say, we have let you into our country. You are making, you're one of the top companies, probably one, a third of the market. Why don't you feel an obligation to build that plant here and put a couple thousand Americans to work?
Excellent.
That makes sense to me. And everybody I've talked to said, yeah, why aren't they doing that? And why isn't somebody calling on these people and embarrassing them to say, what kind of a company are you?
Well, that's an excellent point.
That you're laying off Americans, you're closing down plants in Pennsylvania, and you're moving the work out, and you're putting people on the curb. That is wrong in America.
Well, I mean, in talking about Hershey, I mean, you look at what's been going on here locally with the J-1 Cultural Exchange Program, where they're exploiting workers from China and Russia to work in their factories. It's insane. But you bring up the question, why doesn't the president get on the phone? And I've been asking that question quite often. Why isn't the president doing what he said he was going to do as campaign Obama? Why isn't he doing that as President Obama? And I think what you've done is you've sparked something that's going to get people like me to look back at him and say, okay, take this ball and run with it. Where are you going to go from this point here?
Well, he wants jobs in this country, and that's one of the ways to create jobs. The federal government can't put 20 million people to work. That's just unrealistic. We've got to get these corporations off the sidelines. They've got to basically start bringing some of these jobs home. You know, they could bring back, right now I talked to the head of the CWA, and he was saying that he is negotiating to bring thousands of jobs back from India, these call centers, and bring them back here. It's a relatively simple thing to do because they're realizing the quality isn't there, the customers aren't happy, and basically we lost these jobs, and now it's time to bring those back. Now, we're not going to bring every job that left America back. That's unrealistic. But number one, let's stop the hemorrhaging. Let's stop the plant closings. Let's stop Whirlpool and Mr. Coffee and all these other companies that are leaving this country and throwing workers on the sidelines, and start, number one, stop the hemorrhaging, and number two, maybe start the next plant is here. The next time you build a factory, make it here and put people to work. That's a simple message, and it's a patriotic thing to do.
Absolutely, and we need to take away the incentive for them to go, all the tax
breaks. There is an incentive like that. I was talking to a congressman. He said, can you believe we pay their moving expenses?
Sure we do.
And it's some kind of a tax break or money from the government.
Yep.
It's insane.
It is.
That is going on because that just promotes, you know, companies like Hershey Chocolate in Reading, Pennsylvania, to close down that plant.
And the one that they keep, they use exploitable labor from other countries. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with General President James Hoffa, president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I wrote an op-ed here locally talking about my grandfather, who, part of the greatest generation, fought the war in World War II, came back home here and fought the war at work, and built the largest middle class in the history of civilization. And I ask the question, where is that generation again? Where's that generation that's going to stand up and say no more, like these kids here at the Hershey factory, these J-1 visa kids? Where's the American worker in all this who's going to stand up and fight back? And sadly, I think we suffer from some bizarre form of Stockholm syndrome that we've been abused for so long. Wages have been taken away, benefits taken away, all of the things that the greatest generation fought for, we've just had it taken away for us, and we don't seem to want to fight for them.
Well, I think you're right. I think that is the message of what happened in November of 2010. How is it that we had hundreds of thousands of union people and the people that voted for Obama not vote, and we lost over 700 progressive legislators. We lost six governors. Look what happened in Pennsylvania. We got a Republican governor. We have a Republican, a very conservative, a right-wing senator. And that happened because we fell asleep. And now people are waking up because now they're in there. You've got a John Kasich in Ohio. You've got a Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And they're out there taking away the rights of people to have collective bargaining. And all of a sudden, people are waking up. We had 100,000 people in Madison, Wisconsin. We had 50,000 people in Ohio. So people are waking up. We got over 1 million signatures to get rid of this bill that takes away this ban on collective bargaining for firemen and policemen. So we are fighting back. But the answer is, this has got to be our wake-up call.
Absolutely.
And this right-wing movement has got to be a wake-up call. This idea of trying to get right to work in every state, that's got to be a wake-up call. So when I go out and talk to members, that's what I say. This is a wake-up call. The alarm is going off. And you know what? There are people out there that didn't vote last time. And you know what? The ugly truth is, there are some Teamsters that voted for the John Kasichs. There's some Teamsters that voted for Scott Walker. Now they say, oh, what a mistake I made. What was I thinking? Yeah, it's right. One of the persons that voted, you know, he wants to get rid of, in Ohio, he wants to sell the Ohio Turnpike. Well, guess what? One of the persons that voted for him
she works on the turnpike. She's going to lose her job. You know what? This is a reality check.
Absolutely, and it's time for people to start thinking about their paychecks and their pocketbooks first, and where they work and where those jobs are going to go.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see the president's going to give his speech. I think it's going to be a great speech, and the Republicans are going to take him on and stop everything he's doing. And eventually, we're going to have a train wreck, because we're not getting anything done. They intend to obstruct him all the way through the end of this year and all of next year. And eventually this is going to have to be settled at the polls in November of 2012. And the president has got to draw a line and say, look, this is what I stand for, and this is what they stand for. They stand for right to work. They stand for taking away from working families. They stand for, not taxing the rich. They stand for getting rid of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And I stand for just the opposite. I stand for what's right about America. And you draw a line and you say, which one of these do you want?
And that's
if you do it that way, I think we can win.
Yeah, that's a place to start. And also by energizing, because I've been questioning how are we going to get union members energized. And I think you have lit the fuse.
That's our message.
And congratulations. Anybody who ticks off the T-Twitch the way you have is all right in my book. President Hoffa, thanks so much for
the
time.
Talking to you again.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone on.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Well, that's the message. Heed the warning, T-Twits. We're coming for you. And I'm sure that'll make fake news on Fox as well. I want to thank Herman before we move on. Herman emailed me during the break telling me that the movie that I was trying to think of, Idiocracy, the movie Idiocracy, if you haven't seen Idiocracy, it is a dumb movie, but it's where we're heading. It is really, really scary where we're going. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I've got Kevin on line two. How are we doing tonight, Kevin?
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
It's exciting to see
President Hoff to get out there and lay the fuse on Labor Day weekend, something that needed to be said a long time ago, and hopefully it will energize and fire some people up, and we'll start moving some things in the right direction.
Of the two versions, which was your favorite?
Oh, I like Fox's version.
Yeah, me too.
You know, lay it out there.
I just think this is great.
President Obama, this is your army. We are ready to march. Let's take these son of a out and give America back to America where we belong. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that was better. I mean, in fact, I think Fox did him a service by throwing that out there. And thank you, Fox.
Oh, I had to look up my friends out over the weekend. This is the best thing Fox could have done. They laid it out better than you know, we would have cut it up ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nice pair of scissors over there. I mean, generally they get caught doing that, and they got caught in this. You know, like when they, with the Glenn Beck thing, where they were using pictures of people in bikinis and then go to the next shot of someone standing there freezing in a parka and try to tell you it's the same rally.
Or the union thugs that they had in Madison when there were palm trees in the background.
That's another beautiful one. But what do you think that, look, I've been beating up on Obama for some time because, to be honest, he hasn't shown me the kind of steely spine, the kind of presidency I was hoping for as campaign Obama. Do you think this could be that spark that maybe gets labor's attention and maybe his attention as well?
Well, I hope so. You know, Hoff earlier on your show talked about in 2010 we went to sleep. Well, I don't necessarily think we just went to sleep. I think there was a lot of dissatisfaction and disappointment in how the Obama administration had kind of dropped the ball on some promises that they made or the direction we thought that he'd be taking. And if he would just move back in that direction, if he would lead, if he'd get out there at the tip of the spear and lead, I think the rest of us would follow.
Yeah. See, I've always said that the reason that Republicans tend to win elections and take the white working class, you know, blue collar guy into their fold is because they're decisive, and that's what people like me want to see. They want to see a guy who's gonna stand up, fight back, and if you need to get smacked in the mouth every once in a while, they're gonna smack you. And I don't know that people see Obama in that light.
No, I think he's tried to make a genuine effort at bipartisanship and trying to reach compromise. And that he's forgetting who he's dealing with, because those folks aren't looking at the least bit at compromise. They just want it their way, all the way, every time. And if Obama wakes up and realizes, okay, that's just not going to work, I've got to try something different, I'll go back to what I talked about during the original campaign, we'd all be better off, I think.
I agree. Thursday night, the speech, what are you thinking is going to come out?
Well, I hope he's going to put some concrete facts out there and not just talk in generalities. I mean, we need a jobs program. You know, President Hoff is right about the government can't do it all, but we can certainly get out there and lead. There's a million things in this country that need done. The infrastructure's falling apart. That by itself would create a ton of jobs. You know, the recent earthquake that we had here on the East Coast, you know, brought to light a lot of things about nuclear power plants and the restructuring that needs to be done there and the modernization that needs to be done there. There are tons of jobs out there, but, you know, you talked about something interesting on your show earlier about corporations. There was a time in this country when corporations took pride in being American, and they displayed their patriotism by doing the right thing by their workers and doing the right thing by their country. We don't see that now, and that's something that's really lacking. And maybe with some leadership in Washington, some of those people would start to take that to heart as well.
And maybe some consumers who said, you know what, we're not going to use your product anymore unless it's an American-made product. Maybe if we start thinking, since they've turned us into a consumer nation, we're no longer workers first, we're consumers first. Maybe if we start thinking that way, then, hey, you bring those jobs back, and maybe we'll use your service again.
Works for me. Nothing like buying American and buying union.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin, I appreciate the call, man.
Thanks, Rick. Keep up the good work, man.
Thanks. Always great talking to you. You know, the thing is, and I've talked about this a number of times, you know, you think about all the jobs that could be created just doing the work that's gone undone. Granny's house needs painting. Granny needs some work done around the house. You know, there's a whole bunch of concrete work that can be done. Just tons of stuff that's not being done that we can get people back to work on. Now, what I fear Thursday is I fear that we're going to hear about the Georgia plan. I haven't heard an awful lot, but there's been some whispers that maybe gonna do this Georgia plan. And if you don't know what it is, basically what they've done in Georgia, from what I understand, is that people who are on unemployment, who are collecting unemployment, they go to work. Well, I guess you can't go to work. Yeah, I guess you can't say that. because they're not actually working for the company. They go in like an internship, if you will. They take an internship with this company, and the government gives them both a little bit of money, a little stipend to cover costs. And at the end of the program, the employer gets the opportunity to decide if they're going to hire them, which sounds like a great idea. So, hey, we're getting people into the workplace, you know, sharpen up their skills, get them, you know, kind of in that training period, you know, with the idea that this good patriotic American company is going to help out and hire one or two people. But what ends up happening is, and I guess it's borne out in the numbers, because some of the numbers I saw were between 15 and 17% of these employers that take on these folks, these unemployed folks, actually hire them, which is pathetic. Because you've got people out there who are just going to abuse the free program. And we're going to end up subsidizing free labor for these corporations so they can pocket more money. And then the worst part of it, the more perverse part of this is, end up laying people off that they had already hired to bring them back on the rolls and thus benefit from them. That's what scares me. I hope that is not part of his speech. I hope he sticks to the meat and potatoes, the bread and butter, the stuff that really is going to make a walloping punch, which is, you know what? Like the structural engineers said, $2.2 trillion we need right now just to make up-to-date improvements, just to make our infrastructure reasonable today, and then another $2 trillion to make it a 21st century infrastructure. I don't know if you've been driving up and down our roads, but they are clogged constantly around here. That, mark the calendar, again, because I've been telling you this for a while, is only going to get worse in the next 10 years, the next 20 years. So the longer we let this thing go down the road, the longer we push the buck, the worse it's going to be, and the harder it's going to be to fix. And that's what worries me, the harder part. And we're just kicking it off onto our kids. Anyway, remember last month? The Republicans, they were steadfast in their hatred of unions, so they decided that they weren't going to reauthorize the FAA spending, and basically over Delta Airlines, they shut down all operations for the Federal Aviation Administration. I think it was like 70 to 90,000 workers out into the streets. Not to mention all of the construction projects that were stopped. Not to mention the $30 million a day that we lost in uncollected airline taxes, and the company just pocketed. Gotta love that. 10 days. We got 10 days, and we could see the FAA, the sequel. We could see this happen again. And I look at this, and I go, you know, I wish I were in Congress. I do at this moment, because what I would do is I would propose a bill just for my district that would say, you know what, I want to use the same rules that the Republicans want for workers to organize a union in my district, that anyone who doesn't vote, not anyone who votes yes or no, they're immaterial here. Any person who doesn't vote is a vote for me. Do you think they'd go for it? Do you think that the Republicans would buy it? Of course they wouldn't. But that's how the elections are set up for folks covered under the Railway Act. If there's an election for, you know, I want to have a union at Delta Airlines, or I want to have a union at FedEx, or wherever that's covered under this. Anyone who doesn't vote, automatically a no vote. It's not counted as a non-vote. It's a no vote. Where every other voting structure in the country, and you remember when Joe the unlicensed plumber was here in Harrisburg with Freedom Works? Or was it Americans for Prosperity? I don't know. I get them screwed up. They're both funded by the billionaires. But they came here with their little voting booth, and they said voting is so important that every vote counts. Every vote cast must count for something. But now what they're saying is, yes, well, we believed that then. But now we believe that every vote not cast, that counts too, and it counts as a no. Do you think they'd go for it if I said, just in my little district? Of course they wouldn't. But, you know, that's what we're heading back towards. So 10 days and counting until this happens again. So we'll keep an eye on that, because, again, you look at our infrastructure. You know, how many times over the past year have we talked about planes running into each other in the airports? There are infrastructural improvements that are going on right now to kind of help that. In 10 days, that could all stop again. In 10 days, all those workers gone. So, we will be keeping an eye on that. Evidently, Mitt Romney didn't want to get swept up by the jobs thing. He decided he was not only going to preempt President Obama, but also John Boehner and Cantor, the other idiot. Romney came out with a 59-point economic plan. 59 points. And, look, the mass of them, you know, the top ones, tax cuts for the rich, be that any of the tax cuts. I'm sure 58 of the 59 are how can we get more money into the hands of the very wealthy. And then 59 is deregulate everything and pollute the hell out of everything. I'm sure that's it. But it's 160 pages. And I was thinking about how much time and how much effort and how much spent energy he has given to this courting of the T-twits. And I look at this 160-page plan, and I go, man, have you blown it? You were there. You spent time. You were courting them. You were going in for the big kiss, and all of a sudden you decided to slap them with 160 pages. Did you learn nothing from Herman Cain?
That's why I'm going to only allow small bills. Three-page
bills. See, Herman Cain speaks tea. He gets it. He speaks Tea Party so much. Small bills, 3 pages, because you can read those over dinner. Granted, there'll be nothing in them, and there'll be no real protections for anyone except corporate America. But he gets it. Smaller, you know, Bushian type language. Romney, come on, buddy. 160 pages. Could you whittle that down to 5? 160 pages. This is why you're not going to win the party's nomination. And to be honest, I'm glad you're not, because he was probably the guy who had the best opportunity to win against Obama. Please, you know, give me Bachman. If you know, some K-Sara Sara gets done, running on the yellow brick road there in Tea Party Row, let's get her into the race, too. I'd love to see her and Bachman and Perry go at it. Just 3 girls going at it, you know? Interesting, fun stuff. This jobs thing to me is huge. And on Thursday, we're going to be talking to a bunch of people, getting their opinions of the big speech. Again, I'm hoping bold. I'm hoping he takes a play out of the Republicans' book and says, you know what? We're going to have massive, mind-blowing vision. You know, nation-changing vision. No, and you're not going to get anywhere close to what you want. But saying, this is my vision for the country, throwing it out on the table like the Republicans do. When Bush ran around talking about privatizing Social Security in 2005, when he had his file cabinets going, they're just full of IOUs, a whole bunch of IOUs, just paper, just nothing but paper. Not to mention that it's backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government, and it is where most of our Social Security is, in those little things called treasury bonds. Never mind that. But it's broke. And everybody, he was soundly rejected. Here we are, a couple years later. What are we talking about? You guessed it. Cutting Social Security. So, you know, they understand the long cast. They understand throwing out the outrageous and getting it onto the table. I'm saying, oh, buddy, out onto the table, man. Long cast. And then you like you do in any negotiation, you throw the what I want out there, and you get what you can. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the thing going on out in Chicago. We're going to talk with Alex Han, Deputy Director of Stand Up Chicago, standupchicago.org, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and this free trade agreement that may be coming. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Secretary Treasurer Dennis Williams says the Auto Workers Union is vigorously working to organize foreign automaker factories in the U.S. And he says despite concessions the UAW has given up recently, American workers at those foreign automaker plants have strong reasons to join the United Auto Workers.
By joining it together and having the union like a UAW, they can have a voice, a true voice in the workplace. When they have concerns, whether it be quality, whether it be health and safety, they have a true voice. We have voted as an entire executive board to go after the transnational plants in the United States and to use all the resources necessary to achieve this.
The UAW is trying to convince foreign automakers to stay neutral in union organizing drives. Williams says current UAW leadership believes that a non-adversarial relationship best serves both workers and unions in auto factories.
We want companies to be very profitable. If they're profitable, our members are profitable, and the standard of living raises, and the communities have more of a tax base. So to have an adversarial relationship just don't make sense. We are prepared to spend millions of dollars on organizing their facilities. It doesn't make good business sense for them to fight a worker's right to have a fair democratic election.
As people in Ohio battle to repeal an attack on collective bargaining rights, there's new data showing worker wages there have fallen since 2000. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohioans that are lucky enough to be employed are on average earning less. A study recently released by Policy Matters Ohio discovered that the median hourly wage in Ohio has fallen by 86 cents since the year 2000. The median wage is now $15.16 per hour, down from $16.02 per hour, a pay cut of nearly $2,000 for full-time hourly workers. That wage drop isn't completely universal in the state. The top 10% actually saw their median wages increase by 2.4%. The median wage loss for the bottom 50% of wage earners was 5.4%. The drop in wages in the state likely isn't a surprise to economists. According to the study, Ohio was responsible for a quarter of the job losses in the United States during the last decade, and when the unemployed do find new work, it tends to be at a lower wage. Ohio wasn't alone when it comes to states seeing a wage cut. The Buckeye State leads a pack of 10 states, where wages went in the opposite direction of the national average. Nationally, the median wage has increased over the last decade by 51 cents per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. I want Congress to pass a set of trade deals. Send a message to Congress to come to an agreement on trade deals.
They're selling make-believe, we don't buy that. In the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So earlier today, John Boehner and Eric Cantor, they sent a letter to the president saying, hey, we've got some free trade agreements that we might be able to agree on. That Colombia, Panama, South Korea, we could using the White House's numbers, and I don't know where they pulled these out of. They're claiming it's going to create 250,000 jobs. The only thing I've seen that I put any real credence in is that we're going to probably lose, because of these three trade agreements, somewhere in the neighborhood of 155 to 159,000 jobs. So I'm not sure where the 250 created is coming from. Maybe just wishful thinking. But again, the president has said he wants these trade agreements, but he wants some retraining programs, and he wants some benefits under the TAA to make sure that the people affected, those 155 to 159,000 who lose their jobs, and they will, get some retraining for jobs that probably aren't going to be here, and some additional benefits. And the Republicans promised that they might consider it. So I guess, that means we're going to be going full steam ahead on these trade agreements. I got this thing. Ben and Jerry's is joining local groups in Chicago to talk about this Trans-Pacific Partnership and the traded deal that may come out of it. That's why I've asked Alex Han. He is the deputy director of Stand Up Chicago. StandUpChicago.org is their website, to come talk to us about the event and also the Trans-Pacific Partnership and I guess free trade agreement that'll come out of that. Alex, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me, what's going on with the ice cream people?
With the ice cream people? Well, you know, it's great to have the support of Ben and Jerry, who actually came out yesterday to a Labor Day rally that we had in downtown Chicago, and a march to the site of the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They also brought free ice cream for the whole rally. So.
Yeah, rallies are always much better with ice cream. Cookies, too.
Yeah,
like we
it really helps.
When we were in Wisconsin for the big uprising there with 150,000 people in the streets, the greatest thing was is the cookies. The free everywhere you went, there were nice old ladies handing us cookies.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, never hurts.
Yeah, it never hurts. You know, I was expecting a riot, and I got cookies and sweet potatoes. But let's talk about this Trans-Pacific Partnership for a bit, because it's a really a smaller version of many of the other trade agreements that we have. Currently, we just have a kind of a partnership agreement at this point, correct?
Yeah. You know, I'm not the best expert on all the specifics, but, yeah, that's my understanding.
And we're talking about actually inking some trade deals? Is that where we're going with this?
Yeah, and, you know, the trade deal right now is being negotiated by the U.S. and trade ministers from eight other Pacific Rim countries. You know, they're working to reach a deal. And I think the initial timeline was by November, although it's unclear whether that's actually going to happen. Right.
Because I'm looking at the nations on the list, Chile, New Zealand, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, Peru, Australia, and then us. And I'm going, you know, what's in it for us, really? Because most of the countries, with the exception of Australia, exploitable labor countries.
Right. Yeah, you know, this is kind of, you know, with a lot of the corporations that kind of have an interest in this deal, looking at countries like Vietnam, like some of these other countries involved in these negotiations, looking at even lower labor options to a place like China.
So you had 10,000 hand-signed postcards. What's the point in that? Did I lose him?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second.
Oh, okay. Well, you guys had 10,000 hand-signed postcards that you delivered to negotiators. What are you hoping comes out of that?
Yeah, well, actually today we attempted to deliver them to the negotiators, but hotel security and the Chicago Police Department would not allow us into the building to do that. So over the next few days, these negotiations are happening until the 15th in the Hilton in Chicago. So I think we'll have several other opportunities to make sure we get the U.S. delegation. You know, the point of the postcards was for, you know, regular people around the country, you know, here in Chicago and around the country, to be able to say that we want strong, clear, and enforceable labor standards based on ILO conventions, that we want an end to investor-to-state provisions that allow corporations to threaten environment and consumer protection. We want a clear mandate enabling countries at affordable generic cases for sick people. And we want to respect community's decisions as to how to protect family farmers and how to feed their population.
All great things, and all things that I think should be in any trade agreement, you know, just from the country wanting to protect its own people and not
right.
put it at the mercy of those willing to exploit, destroy, and pollute their own country, let alone someone else's.
That's exactly right. We actually had almost 20,000 postcards.
Wow, good for you. You know what I don't understand? I don't understand why they didn't just said, okay, have one person go and hand in your cards and thanks, goodbye, and just dismiss. Why this fight? Why this? Now there's a deal. There's a deal here. There's something that's going to enrage people like me who says, you know, why can't you just at least listen to one person?
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I think we had actually a lot of passed by. When we're talking to them, we're asking that same question. You know, but they don't want anybody in these negotiations. They want to be able to do this under cover of darkness. And so, you know, everything that we do that kind of brings more attention and more light to these negotiations is something that they don't want.
And this is the kind of stuff that enrages. And this is where I agree with a lot of the right-wing crazy people who hate government. When you see stuff like this, you can't defend it. I want these proceedings to be open, transparent. I want to know what's going on. I want to know if I'm going to get screwed by these deals and who in this country is going to be harmed.
Right. Right. No, I mean, there's, you know, we've obviously seen the effects of trade deals in the past, right? Here in Chicago, we've got the third highest metropolitan poverty rate in the country. And something that certainly has contributed to that is the fact that we've lost at least 35,000 jobs in Illinois directly due to NAFTA, right? And that's one agreement that we've had. You know, working families are obviously worried about the impact that any new trade agreement is going to have on unemployment. We also understand that big banks and corporations have had a chance to see the draft trade agreements and give input while we're all being kept in the dark, kept out of the room. And so, you know, today and yesterday and different places, you know, people are coming together to demand an agreement that's going to actually put families first.
In this agreement, and maybe you don't know because it is secretive, maybe we can't know, but are there any voices for working people anywhere near the table? I mean, you know, I look in Germany, for instance, I talk to friends who say, you know, the company that they work for, they actually have representatives from the workers sitting on the board of directors. Do we have anything like this, any voice in this at all?
That's a great question, and that's something that people should be asking all over the place, right? We know that all these trade deals, we know who they benefit, Wall Street and the big corporations, and so we know who's at the table in the room, you know, and doing things like our, you know, postcard delivery today and our rally in March yesterday, we're helping to shine a light on what's happening in there.
Is there anything we can do to, you know, just me, my listeners, anything we can do to help this, to open this process? Because if I'm not mistaken, this is probably the sixth or seventh meeting they've had on this?
Yeah. And they're going to have at least one more. You know, I think that people need to be contacting, obviously, their politicians, contacting the administration. You know, we're doing what we can here, and we want to continue to say that we've got a huge problem. We've got an economic crisis. We've got an employment crisis in the U.S., and this is not a way to fix that crisis.
Are you doing any kind of cross-border organizing with, you know, with people in Singapore or Malaysia or Peru or Vietnam?
There have been international folks from some of the different countries that are involved in negotiating this agreement, you know, that are here in Chicago that have been participating with us. And so that's certainly happening across the board.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, that's the only way, Alex, that we fight this back, is to have that cross-border solidarity where we're no longer looking at the workers in Malaysia or Peru or Singapore or Vietnam with a jaundiced eye, but we're looking at them as partners and people that we need to be standing with so that we know who we're fighting against.
No, that's exactly true. And, you know, if a trans-Pacific trade deal can be crafted to actually improve the living standards of ordinary people,
I'm in favor,
whether they're in the United States or anywhere else across the world that this affects, then it's really not worth doing.
Yeah, I'm in favor of a deal that's going to lift everybody up, not just a handful of very wealthy people who don't consider themselves Americans or any other country. They're global citizens.
Right.
And they want to be able to take they want to take the prizes of their exploitation and do what they want, free of you and me.
No, that's exactly true. So we want to be able to tell the U.S. negotiator and the other trade ministers that we expect a fair deal or we expect no deal when it comes to this trade policy.
I'm right there with you. What can we do right now? Is there anything right today? Can we go to standupchicago.org would be a start. Any call to action there?
Yeah, you can certainly go to standupchicago.org for information. Also, Citizens Trade Campaign at citizenstrade.org, which is a national umbrella organization of different labor and community groups, family farm groups, and environmental groups. You know, they've been working hard on this issue.
Yeah, Lori Wallach's people. She does a great job over there for them.
Yeah.
And again, you know, we'll have a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Alex Hand's name. Lastly, you know, in looking at these agreements, any way to stop the bad ones? I mean, we've been talking about Colombia. We've been talking about South Korea. We've been talking about Panama. And I'm saying we got to stop these. I'm afraid we're not going to get as much attention on this Trans-Pacific Partnership or this trade agreement as we're going to get on those other ones. And this one might just slip right on by us.
Yeah, no, and those, you know, the other trade deals with Korea, Panama, Colombia could come up for a vote in Congress, you know, this fall. And so I think having, you know, activity around this and making sure that we're making it clear that, you know, we're not just talking about something that's happening across the globe. We're talking about something that has a real impact, you know, for us here in Chicago We can see the impact of this, and we know it's going to happen if people don't get their voices heard in the process.
And that's why we need to call our representatives and be outraged. Don't be nice. You know,
right.
Tell them
exactly.
No. Alex Hand,
that
I appreciate
good to me.
Alex Hand, I appreciate the time. Deputy Director of Stand Up Chicago, standupchicago.org is the website. We got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Alex, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for having me, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Class majority. Rick Smith.
Presidential wannabe Rick Perry is flitting hither, thither, and yon, spreading little Perry tales about the economic miracles he has produced in Texas. Fantasy number one is a creationist story about jobs. As he recently flitted across Iowa, he gushed that he has built, quote, a job-creating machine in the state of Texas. And a Perry aide flatly said, the governor's job creation record speaks for itself. Actually, it doesn't. Probe even an inch into the million job number that Perry tosses around like fairy dust, and you'll learn that these are mostly jobettes that can't sustain a family. Most come with very low pay and no health care or pension, and many are only part-time or temporary positions. Indeed, more than a half million Texans now work for minimum wage or less, a number that has doubled since 2008, leaving Texas tied with Mississippi for the nation's highest percentage of its workforce reduced to poverty pay. Spreading even more fairy dust, Perry claims that his Texas miracle is the result of him keeping the government out of the private sector's way. But peek behind that ideological curtain, and you will find this startling fact. During Perry's decade, the growth in private sector jobs has been a relatively paltry 9%. While the public sector has more than doubled that, increasing the number of local, state, and federal workers in Texas by 19%. One out of six employed Texans are now teachers, police officers, highway engineers, military personnel, and other government workers. And many of these jobs were created with federal money, including cash from Obama's stimulus program. There's his miracle. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, joblessness is on the rise in Texas, and the whole Perry tale is about to go poof, thanks to his recent multi-billion-dollar budget cuts that will destroy more than 100,000 good jobs throughout the state of Texas.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Since the investor class, diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind. If you miss any portion of the program, just go to the website, download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app, which we have right there on our website, and take your class war on the go. So I was reading an Associated Press article titled Missouri Lawmakers Seek to End Tax Breaks for Poor. And we're seeing this all across the country. The idea that we can steal from these poor people who really have no voice, who have no ability to defend themselves. And look, they're only going to become poorer and dependent on some other program, or heaven forbid, end up in the streets committing crimes and end up costing us 10 times more by having to be incarcerated. But I was reading through the article, and I guess today the Missouri legislature is going back to work. And the idea is, and this is one of those things that just makes you go, wow, this is the game plan, huh? They're going to take away this low-income tax credit that they say benefits about 106,000 disabled and elderly people in the state of Missouri through this rental program they have. They're also going to take back some additional tax credits for low-income folks. They're saying that it could save about $855 million over the next 15 years. And I love that save thing. The government's saving money. I'm not buying it. The savings end up being stolen from somebody. Somebody's suffering over this. In Wisconsin, for instance, when we talked to Mark Anderson earlier, the savings were $20 million less in income to the state workers, which means $20 million less money being spent locally in local businesses. But it means $20 million more in the hands of the wealth class, of the Koch brothers and all the millionaires and billionaires there, so that they can take it out of the state and invest it in wherever. I mean, this is something we've really got to start talking about in this country. If we hand all this money to the wealth class, as we've been told to do for a generation now at least, ever since Reagan came in with this trickle-down nonsense, we've had this idea pounded in us ad nauseum. I mean, it's been beaten into me like not writing with my left hand was beaten into me when I was a kid by the nuns. Or making my fours like flags. The nuns hated that, and they beat me with great repetitive, with vigor and anger. If we could do that, only reversing all of the 30, 40 years of Reaganomics, all of this, oh, just let everything flow to the top. And you know what? Eventually their pockets get full enough that something falls out over the edges. And then we can scurry for that, and we can fight over the crumbs. Their pockets never end, man. We have given them trillions. Not millions, not billions. We have given them trillions of dollars. They're sitting on mounds of cash. They're not helping us. And here, the savings, the quote-unquote $855 million in savings coming from disabled people, coming from the elderly. And where's it going to go? Oh, please ask that question. Oh, Rick, where's that money going to go? Well, we already know where it's going to go. They're saying part of it's going to be used to lure, and I love that word, lure, Chinese cargo planes into the St. Louis airport. So we're going to bypass those union people at the ports because we've got to break that up. So we're going to fly planes, cargo planes, into St. Louis so that we can have a couple of jobs unloading the planes. And then a couple of truck drivers who come in and, you know, eat at the bad restaurants, create a couple of jobs there, too. And, of course, with the rest of it, that means more money for businesses to suck off the government teat, if you will. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, don't we have to stop what we're doing? Don't we have, you know, there was this woman back during the 80s, 90s. Her name was Susan Powder. She was a fat woman who became really, really skinny. And her catch line was, stop the insanity. When will we ever stop the insanity of this bizarre notion that if we hand enough to the wealth, if we hand all of the treasure to the top, because they know they're the creme de la creme, they're the smart people, they know what to do with money, they'll put it to work in the best way. Yeah, for them, not for society, not for workers, not for this nation. They could give a rat's behind about this country. What they care about? Themselves. And their profit. And they don't want to pay taxes. They've been quite clear about that. And they've spent billions of dollars making sure that they don't have to. I mean, stop and think for just a little while how amazing it has been since 1953 that they have been able to lower their top tax rate from 92% all the way down to 35%. And better yet, the smart ones, the smart investor class, the people who make their money gambling on Wall Street, they have taken it from 93% all the way down to 15%. And you've got politicians. You've got Republicans and a handful of Democrats, but mostly Republicans, especially Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs running for president. They want to eliminate the capital gains tax so we can take it all the way down from 93 to zero. That is that's amazing. And yet we working people, we are going to look at Granny and the disabled people and say, well, we're going to take that away from you because we need to feed at the altar of the wealth. So that hopefully, maybe, please, possibly, oh, would you create a job? I mean, it's mind-blowing. It's insane, if you will, but we keep buying into it. And why? Because that's where our education system has taken us. And I look at the fact that the Koch brothers themselves have, you know, and it's no secret now. The gig is up, man. They've been paying some universities to have a say on who's hired on the economics faculty, who the economic professors are going to be. And for very little money. I think it was Florida State University, a fairly sizable university, $2 million to have say in who the economics professors are going to be. That's mind-blowingly cheap. And if you really stop me to think about the people in Washington, the 435 members of the House and the 100 in the Senate, how cheap it is to buy them. Well, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. You know, a couple grand here, a couple grand there to get what you want is amazing. Which is why I say, and why I think Hoffa's right, we need to get out and vote for people who are going to stand up and fight for us. We need to create a voting populace, not of Democrats or Republicans, but of working people who are going to say, I don't give a damn which party you are, but you're going to stand up for collective bargaining. You're going to stand up for the rights of workers to be safe on the job. You're going to stand up for the right of workers to be able to support their families, policies like Medicare, policies like, prevailing wage, policies like Social Security, and make sure that we have an environment for working people to thrive and survive in. And all of you crazy people who keep going, oh, we need open borders for capital. Yes, that's a wonderful thing. And we need exploitable labor. We need to do away with all those labor restrictions because they're just so onerous and so difficult. And they, you know, they drive up the price of my profit. They take away from my profits. I mean, I saw over the weekend, we need to relook at the prevailing wage laws. Yeah, so we can use cheap exploitable labor. Yes, let's have that transient labor come through. We can have them live in our hotels, and it's good for the hotel industry because they'll book up the whole hotel. And yet, you got people who go, well, sounds like a reasonable idea. They'll do it for 30% less. It'll cost us 30% less to build our schools. Which, again, shows us how dumb we are because we don't know basic math. Because labor costs are, what, a quarter, 30% of the overall cost of the building? So in order to save 30% of the overall costs, those workers would have to pay to work there. Just simple math. I'm no genius. But they make such nice arguments, such beautiful arguments. We need to take this money from the poor people so that we can get those rich people to hire the poor people. Well, why don't we just use the money that we took from the poor people that we gave to the rich people to hire the people to do the job for us? Oh, gee, that sounds too much like logic. Don't do that. I mean, it's nuts, isn't it? You stop back during the Bush years. And, you know, I can't believe he said it, but he did. You know, he was talking about his big cuts. Yeah, we're gonna make sure that we give tax cuts to all the wealthy people. Because you see, wealthy people, they know what to do with jobs. See, they create, they create stuff, and they know what to do. So we give them all the kind of money that they need, and they go out and they create them jobs. See, create the jobs. They know what to do because they're rich people, and rich people know that. It's that simple.
Rich people don't create jobs. Companies create jobs.
Oh. Don't say that, Mr. Block. That might get a thought into somebody's head.
The wealthy have a debt to this country, and they can afford to pay it, and they should.
Heresy! Heresy! I can't believe he said that. I can't believe it. Oh, my God.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
1 million new jobs. $550 billion. That's $550,000 a job. How do I get that? That's what we gave away in the hopes that they'll create those jobs. It doesn't happen. And I'm a firm believer of no more subsidies for corporations. Sorry, we'll buy your products. You know how? We'll give people money, and they can buy their products. Like in the solar panel industry, the smartest thing we could have done was not giving loan guarantees or any of that stuff, saying, you know what? We need solar panels. We want solar panels on every federal office building. And you people, you companies, you will compete for that business. Everybody's happy. The free market's going, oh, boy, we can do this. And the entrepreneurs are going, oh, boy, we can do this. And everybody's all happy because there's a product to be purchased. And you know what? That little thing called demand hires people to meet the demand. Pretty simple. But somehow along the line, we've kind of forgotten that. Maybe it's those economics professors that the Koch brothers have hired to teach in our fine institutions. Just a thought. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, right back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Sitting at the kitchen table with Tom and his laptop.
My name's Tom, and I'm here today to learn how to save money on my prescriptions with Capital Blue Cross.
Capital's VP of Pharmacy Services, Meenock, is here. She's showing Tom how to use the Capital website to learn his prescription price before he heads to the pharmacy today.
You would want to know what is the cost of that medication to basically stretch your health care dollar, because that's your dollar.
The point is, members have options to save time and money. And if Tom wants to log on at 1 a.m. to renew a prescription, that's fine, too.
Having that flexibility to be able to order prescriptions at any time of the day or night is fantastic. And the mail order feature is really like a self-service feature. We love that.
Meenock doesn't usually make house calls, but today she's happy to help.
This is one of the ways we care more, so we do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Now to get our update from what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
I guess the gang of 435 are back?
They are indeed. Yes, today, actually, in Washington, D.C., is known as Terrible Traffic Tuesday.
I can imagine.
Yes, it's a bad day today. But they're back. The Senate in particular is back today. The House gets back tomorrow. Tomorrow night is a big Republican debate. Then Thursday night is a big president's speech and on jobs. And today the Senate started hearings. Tomorrow the House starts, whatever it's going to start. Deregulating things, actually, is what the House is going to start doing. And then, of course, the super committee flies in with brooms and capes and meets.
Oh, boy, I can't wait for that. And I guess on Friday, Joe Walsh will be returning from Illinois, the congressman there who evidently doesn't know how to pay child support. I guess he'll be back on Friday because he said, I haven't seen an update, but he said he's not going to sit and watch the president speak. He's going to be out with the real people.
Is that what he said?
Yes.
Well, good for him.
Mister, I can't pay my child the $120,000 that I owe the child. Mr. Family
yeah.
Values.
That's nice.
Mr. Fiscal Responsibility.
That's nice.
You gotta love that. I hope his wife gets every dime of it and takes every penny he gets. So that he's living on a cardboard box out in front of the White House while serving in Congress.
Oh, dear.
So I'm hoping for. So they're back, and I guess all of the obstruction, all of the gridlock, especially over this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau nominee.
This is fascinating. Richard Cordray, former Ohio Attorney General, who is currently the chief enforcer of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which sounds very tough, is up to be the first director thereof. And it's fascinating. He found himself today before the Senate Banking Committee to discuss his nomination. But he was sort of playing a bit part, really, because, you know, he made his statement and had a lot of things to say. Then the senators make opening statements. Well, committee ranking member Richard Shelby only mentioned Cordray in passing. Actually, he didn't even talk about his qualifications for the job. In fact, he said the hearing was premature as long as the CFPB exists in its current form. Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, who's fairly mild-mannered usually, accused his Democratic colleagues of using half-truths, misuse, and untruths, that I'm shocked to hear the spewing from almost everyone on the other side of the dais.
Wow, amazing. Could it be that they just do not want this position to ever be filled? You could probably, and I won't go as far to say you get somebody from Goldman Sachs to run it, because that's who they would want, but they want absolutely nobody running this thing.
Yes, they have said that. 44 Republican senators have vowed to block any nominee to head the Bureau unless the director is replaced by a board. Its budget is brought under the control of congressional appropriators, and it's required to consider what they are calling the safety and soundness of banks in creating rules.
Correct. So put the banks first and not us, not the people. Worry about the banks. Worry about making sure that they're taken care of. Yeah, I say we replace
it like that.
I say we replace it with a board. We go back to what, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, walk quietly and carry a big stick. The board I would propose, a 2x4. Pretty simple in my opinion. And, you know, anybody who disagrees, you just give them a little tap. Walk softly. Amazing.
That'll do it.
Amazing stuff. And it's just, again, they don't believe in government. They don't want it to be around. And we still vote for people who hate our government. Very, very, very interesting. The post office, big news, I guess. They're, I guess, broke. And it, from the people that I've talked to, it's not operational. It's this bizarre pension thing that we've hoisted upon them.
It's the pension thing. It's the fact that they $10 million short. The fiscal year is ending at the end of September. They're going to have about a week's money in the bank. But basically what they want to do, what Mr. Donahoe wants to do, is he went before the Senate Homeland Security Committee today to say, look, what I need you to give me permission to do is to get down to 5 days a week delivery, which, by the way, the American public supports.
Yeah, I see it as a job killer, though. I mean, can you really afford to lose that many jobs at a time when we're still in, and I say we're still in recession?
Well, that, if they were just going to do that, I actually would support it. That's not just what they're going to do. They want to lose 220,000 jobs.
Yep. Yeah, we talked about this with the head of the Postal Union there not too long ago, and the way he laid it out is, look, they could very easily solve this problem just by changing the pension requirements that every other corporation, every other corporate entity in this country could do without an act of Congress.
Well, that's not the plan. Of course, they want to close a lot of post offices, too, but they want to lay off 220,000 people. They do want to completely change union agreements when it does come to pension plans and change the currently agreed to plans and institute new plans that would have lesser benefit.
Yeah, you gotta love those people who tell you how much they love the Constitution and the rule of law and they love contracts, and then they go back and say, well, let's go rework all those for those people who put 30, 40 years of their life into serving the public. Great. Why not? Cut them all in half. Put those old people out on the street with tin cups. The Republican way.
It looks like it might be sort of going to happen with the post office.
Amazing. Some other big information this week, the president's speech. Where do you think that's going to go? I got to tell you, I'm not looking for big things. I saw Jay Carney say, you know, they're looking for what's passable. I don't know what that means, but your thoughts?
I think we may hear something quite big from him. We'll hear a couple of biggish things from him, but you're not going to get anything big passed because it's not in the Republicans' interest to allow him to get anything through. I mean, the very fact that we had this bizarre letter from Boehner and Cantor today citing the need for a bipartisan deal on jobs, requesting a meeting with congressional leaders from both parties to discuss his jobs plan ahead of the Thursday night address. I mean, one reason I wouldn't do it if I was the president is that you know the entire speech is then going to be leaked. But the other reason is, what is in it for him to discuss his speech ahead of the speech?
Nothing.
Exactly. Why wouldn't you discuss your speech after the speech?
Well, you'll know when it comes out, especially considering they kind of blew him off for the Wednesday thing, forced him into the Thursday thing, and he bought it. I mean, if I'm president of the United States, I got to tell you, that comes with, to me, and we can disagree, but that comes with some power. And if I say Wednesday night I want to give this speech, you make it happen, figure out how this, wherever I got to do it, that's when I'm doing it.
Right, and so he gave into Thursday, which I actually think is better for him. And into Thursday, it's like, why should I meet with you to talk about my plan?
Exactly. There
is absolutely no upside for the president. The only upside for Boehner and Cantor is for them to be able to say, see, he doesn't want to meet with us.
Yeah. Lastly, President Hoffa. Some interesting comment came out of him that the fake news on Fox people rearranged it. And when I heard it, when I heard the fake news on Fox version, I'm like, yeah, finally, somebody who's saying what I've been saying for the longest time, it's time to stand up and fight back. And then I heard it was doctored. I'm like, oh. But the quote he had was actually pretty good, too. You know, you got to get out and vote. You got to participate in your democracy and throw them bombs out.
It was a strong quotation, and you know the language was incendiary, and it sometimes it's not. I don't think it was smart to use language that incendiary within 15-20 minutes of the president speaking. I don't think it was smart. However, having said that, I don't think that he necessarily needs to apologize. Having said that, I have spoken to any number of radio talk show hosts today who have gone off the deep end about this.
Well, I mean, here, this is an opportunity for them to go off about the union thugs and how they're calling for violence, and that's not what he said. There was nothing in there as a call to violence, and to be honest, that's light compared to what I've heard most T-twits go on about throwing the bums out and doing much, much more than that. In fact, Rick Perry talking about the Fed, do I remember something about that? About how we treat them not so kind down in Texas?
That's right. That's exactly what he said, yes.
But, you know, here at the end of this, labor has got to figure out how they're going to get this president moved to an agenda that can make their members stand up and want to fight for him. And I think this was a good start.
It was certainly a lively one.
So we'll see what happens. We'll see where this goes from here. Victoria Jones, always great talking with you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Tonight, that you could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, you stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Well, you know, generally I say, you know, get up, stand up, take your voice back, you know, get out in the streets. Stand up for everything that's been taken away. You know, do what my grandfather's generation did and create a middle class, create opportunity. But get up, stand up in this instance, a story from Hamilton, Ohio. Evidently, this guy, Edwin Charles Tiburget, he was arrested for, well, public indecency, but evidently he was figuring out how to have sex with a raft. Now, I'm trying to figure out how you have sex with an inflatable swimming raft. Maybe the police have a better understanding of how this all works. But evidently, you know, this guy was witnessed in the alley trying to do something with the raft. The guy who owned the raft, you know, screamed, "Hey, stop!" And the guy ran off, of course, with his beloved raft. He was arrested, and, you know, I guess raft napping, is that a crime? I know it's theft, but, you know, can we charge it since he was actually trying to have sex with it? Can we up that a little bit so we keep people like this off the streets? It's turned out, according to Hamilton County Municipal Records, that this gentleman has had previous arrests five times in the past. For similar offenses. And you gotta wonder, next time you leave your swimming apparatus out, is your raft safe? Good question. And I guess you have to ask the same question. You know, I think we talked about this last week about the guy who was molesting maliciously molested, opened, broke, injured, damaged, and inserted his body parts into a vending machine. I mean, are we really this desperate now? Is this how far it's gone? Are women that difficult to attain? Or even guys, I mean, you know, if you're going to do a vending machine, what's the difference? Or a raft? Really? Wow. God, and I'm trying to figure out the raft. I don't know, maybe, but a vending machine? Really? Well, hey, you know what? I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to judge. You know, whatever they got to do, at least they're not this guy who, you know, I've said this before, I'm not a capital punishment person, but I understand it. Not in favor of it, but if this guy, around my kid, no question. Evidently, bail was set in Mount Clemens, Michigan at $1 million today for the Detroit guy who evidently, and then this is just alleged at this point, he's the guy who has fathered a child with an 11-year-old girl. He is 28 years old. He is facing charges of first-degree criminal conduct, sitting in jail with $1 million bond. He could face life imprisonment. He was arrested on Sunday at his new girlfriend's house. So, again, you know, you got to give them credit. He's moved on. Maybe he found himself a 12-year-old this time. I say that we let him out just for a little while. And whatever happens, happens. You know, there are some things where I go, you know, good old-fashioned justice. This is where I may agree with some of the anarchist. Maybe a little vigilanteism. Or as Mayor Thompson said here, more vigilant vigilantes to take care of folks like this. Speaking of fathering children, there's this social worker in Washington who evidently decided she didn't want to get married, but she wanted to have a child. So she went and used a sperm donor a couple years back, and she got this, you know, this idea that she wanted to search, you know, for any other, you know, siblings that this child may have, which I think is kind of dumb, kind of ruins the whole program, but she did. She got involved in it. And what she's found through this tracking is that this one donor has fathered some 150 children. And you got to go, hey, good for you on one vein, but on the other vein, is that a good thing? Now, I thought in this whole thing it was supposed to be secret. So if you were the guy in there with the magazine and the little cup, the little specimen cup, nobody ever knew who you were. You know, you got your 20 or 30 bucks for, you know, doing what most people do for free, and you moved on your way. And, you know, like any good catalog, you know, the ladies came in and said, oh, yes, this is what I want. So I guess the question then becomes is, you know, do we really need this? But 150. In other countries like Britain, France, and Sweden, they limit the number of donations that become actual children to 5. Here in the U.S., there are no limits, only maybe a guideline or two. And what the worry, I guess, is that, you know, these kids could eventually meet later in life and, well, you know, do whatever it is that grown-up children do. So there you go. And, you know, you know, I read in the article and they're talking about incest, and I think incest, to my mind, is like a moral thing. You know, these are your brothers or sisters, your parents or whatever, because you have this relationship. Now, I don't see it as incest if you have one child on one side of the country who doesn't know about the other on the other side of the country, and somehow I don't see it the same way. Some people may differ, and if you do differ, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, and tell me why. So anyway, the big holiday weekend just passed, and I had a great time at home with my family, and I hope you did too. But, you know, it's the time for, you know, drinking, and a time for partying, and it's time for fairs. I mean, here in Harrisburg, they had the big Capona, but in Dallas, they had a contest for the most creative food. And when you looked at it, you know, you looked at the big, you know, prize pack there. You had buffalo chicken in a flapjack, so you could have, you know, chicken wings in a flapjack with jalapeno crumbs and a little syrup, you know, just a little bit of something. They had these bizarre kind of salsa ball, deep fried salsa balls, which were weird. But the grand winner of the big prize there in Dallas, what were the fried bubblegum balls. Evidently, they took some marshmallow and some bubblegum extract, and they, you know, deep fried the marshmallow and bubblegum, sprayed a little, you know, icing on it, and voila. There you have fried bubblegum, which I guess I don't mind fried bubblegum. You know, it was the fried butter kind of made me, not so much. You know, the fried salsa, not so much. I think this whole fried craze, kind of extreme. Also this weekend, the big winner of the National Buffalo Wing Eating Contest, she pigged out at 183 wings in 12 minutes. I have no idea how you eat 183 wings in 12 minutes. Have no idea. But this woman, one of the top ranked people, I think she's number 5, a woman named Sonia Thomas, 105 pounds. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, you know, 183 wings, they weigh almost as much as she does. How exactly did she stuff 183 wings down her 105 pound mouth in 12 minutes? But there she did. She beat the number one contender in the world, Joey Chestnut. Chestnut ate 174 wings. He is ranked number one in the Major League Eating Championship. Number one. Can you believe this? Eating is now a sport. They're intestinal athletes. scary, scary times. I mean, especially when you think about that, we have people in this world who don't know what they're going to eat in their next meal. They don't know that they're going to get a next meal. And yet, we're gorging ourselves. 183 in 12 minutes. I got to wonder, and does, if anybody knows, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I'd love an answer. Are these people allowed to throw up afterwards? I mean, if you consume that much and you're 105 pounds, I mean, I got to think that you're throwing at least 10 pounds worth of something down your throat. Just a thought. I mean, you know, I'm a big guy. Some would say a big eater. There's no way I couldn't eat 183 wings in an entire day. Let alone in one 12 minute set. It's just absolutely amazing. It's just. And I just got an email during the segment here. Local 776 evidently took first place for their participation in the York Labor Day Parade this year with 13 companies present. So congratulations to our friends over at Teamsters Local 776 for their participation in the Labor Day Parade there in New York. And look, you know, this is the kind of stuff I was talking about, getting people back out in the streets. And I hope next year maybe we can have a Labor Day Parade here. That would be a nice, maybe in every community. Even if it's just a handful of people walking down the street and going, "Hey, you, do you know why you got a weekend?" Maybe that's a good start. Because the sad reality, and there was just a report released that we're going to talk about tomorrow, and we're working on getting a guest to come and talk to us about the fact that labor education in this country is so badly distorted. It's so badly out of whack. That what people think about labor history is so wrong from what reality is. And I've talked about Wisconsin. You know, when we were in Wisconsin, the thing that stuck with me, really honestly and truthfully, the thing that stuck with me is the young people's knowledge of labor history. And I truly believe it was that the second Walker said he was going to call in the National Guard, it was that spark that they said, uh-oh, I've heard this before. I've seen this movie before. That's when the National Guard comes in and starts shooting people. That's when the National Guard comes in and starts breaking things up. And we're on the receiving end of it. And that's when they really came together. And I had a number of people tell me that when he said that sprung them into action. Which is why I think here in Pennsylvania, there needs to be a movement of people somewhere to get labor education into our schools. Because it is important. It's important that people remember what I wrote in my op-ed, that the greatest generation did come home and did create the largest middle class in the history of civilization, the wealthiest, the most prosperous, an actual working class that has opportunity, an actual working class that can look at their child and say, you know what, you're going to have a better life than I've had, and I've had it pretty good. Because I think as parents, we all want that. I mean, I look at my three kids, and I pray that I didn't make the wrong decision in bringing them into the world, because they may not have the opportunities that I've had. And I've been pretty fortunate. You know, I haven't grown up in the projects. Now I live in a really decent neighborhood with opportunity, and I wish that for them in spades. And I wish it for you and your children as well. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests tonight, President Hoffa of the Teamsters, of course, Patty Hines, all of that stuff at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you want to listen to any portion of the program, missed it there. Also, if you got a smartphone, Stitcher, get that. We'll be back tomorrow night. Have a good one.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.